at 6:02 p.m. The meeting is being audio and video recorded, and staff will take a roll call at this time.
Chair Ellen Sprouse? I see you, Ellen, so I'm going to mark you here. Vice Chair Hill?
Here.
Member Drummond?
Here.
Member Jessa?
Here.
Member Johnson is absent. On vacation. Member Medeiros?
Yes.
And Member Oakland?
Yes.
So we do have quorum.
And now, time for public comment. Did we receive any?
I don't have any public comments at this time, though.
Okay. And then we'll move to item number four, approval of the May 6, 2026 regular meeting action minutes.
Did everybody get a chance to review them from the packet?
I thought we kind of stopped in the middle of it.
In the middle of
just like discussing like what we want on the new policies.
Oh, from last time?
Yeah.
I don't remember.
It's after meetings.
Yeah. It's good. You're okay. We could table the minutes and come back to it.
Sure.
If
sure.
That's what you guys would like.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Okay. So, in the meantime, we'll move to action number 5.1, review and approve the 2026-2027 affordable housing table.
That is correct. Please excuse me. I realize I had changed the date on the slide presentation that I put together. So if it is okay with everybody, we have only two items, but they're both pretty big and heavy.
Okay.
So what I think I'd like to do for today, and plus because we're eating, is I'll go through the presentation. If you guys can make note of any questions you have, and then we'll hold them at the end, just because I want to make sure we can definitely get through the next item.
Okay.
All right. So for 2026-27, these are the maximum income limits in order to qualify for any of our affordable housing programs. It's based off of Alameda County. And this information comes from the U.S. Department of HUD that then sends it to HCD. And HCD has a standard calculation as to how we determine this. What I will say is it is extremely late coming out this year. HUD did not release it until May 1st. It usually is released in March or early April, and HCD didn't send it out until the end of May, and that usually happens at the beginning. So it's about a month behind for everybody getting the information, but this is what the numbers look like in regards to what the maximum amount everybody who wants to qualify for one of our programs can make based on their household size. Just to give some context to how things compare between last year and this year, you'll see on the chart on the left that's a household of one. For a very low income person, a household of one would need to make $59,400 in order to qualify. It's about a 6.2% increase in the maximum income. And you can see down below through all those different income categories, from 15% up to 120%, what the change has been. The largest change is happening in the low income category, where it's been about a $7,500 increase for a household of one, representing about 8.6%. The smallest increase is happening at the upper end for moderate income households. Their income increase only was $2,500, about 2%. Looking at it at a larger household, a household of four, you'll see that for a household of four at very low, it's $84,850 in order to qualify. Again, it's about a 6.2. The percentages are pretty much the same regardless of household size as to how much it's gone up from last year to the upcoming year.
I wish we had some more say in those numbers all were created, but I know that we don't.
No.
Right now.
The numbers come from the federal government that is then passed down to the state. They then do another calculation, and then that's how it's given to us. So I will say, while we go through this every year, the numbers are what the numbers are. Can't change them. But we want to present them to everybody. So when it comes to the maximum rent limit, we have here again for Alameda County, what the maximum gross rent limit is for a studio up to a 3-bedroom based off of income tier. These numbers for income is derived by a formula that comes from the state health and safety code that says when looking at someone who is low income, which is 80% of area median income, the rent that is affordable for them shall be dictated off of 60% of the area median income. For all the other categories below that, so if you're at very low, you're at 50% income, it's based off of 50% income for rent. Same thing at 30. But for 80, it's based off of 60% of AMI. And for moderate income, who's at 120%, it's 30% of 110 of AMI. And that, again, is in the California Health and Safety Code. That's how they determine affordability. So that's how these numbers are derived.
And do with work loss, do they apply?
Live work would apply. It's based off of however the city has designated that specific unit. We have some loft style units that are designated 1-bedroom. Some of them are designated 2. And whatever regulatory agreement exists, it'll identify if there is a live work or a loft style unit. It'll designate whether or not it's being interpreted as a 1 or 2-bedroom. And that's in the regulatory agreement from when the property was built. And then that's how then we would determine what the rent would be.
So when they're registered, it'll tell you if it's
not when you get your lease. It's in the regulatory agreement between the city and the developer. Or that's where the determination would fit. Utility allowance. So utility allowances and required fees are the utility allowances published annually by the Housing Authority of Alameda County. That is the utility allowances that are required to use. It establishes what the reasonable cost is associated with utilities based on the number of bedrooms in the unit. It is not based on actual expenses. So it's not based on what somebody actually pays for their electric bill every month. We are all required to utilize what's in the table that is published from the Housing Authority.
I have, sorry, I have another question. The usually like work loss too have like 2 or 3 hours of different.
No distinction. Landlords must deduct a utility allowance for those utilities the tenant is required to pay for, either directly or to a service provider or through the landlord. So most people have their own account with PG&E. They're paying the bill directly. Some properties, the tenant receives a bill along with their rent for the water, for the trash, for other type of things. Whether you're paying it to the landlord or that third-party metering company or you're paying it directly to the service provider, if those utilities the tenant is paying, they have to use the utility allowance. And the chart that I provided here, which is, again, updated every year by the Housing Authority, the rows that are highlighted are the ones that we most commonly see in properties. Not every property has these same requirements. If there's gas, it's going to be a different utility allowance than if it's electric. If the tenant isn't required to pay for trash, it'll be a different one. But this is what we see most common. So for a studio, it's usually about $231 for a utility allowance down to a 3-bedroom, $499. Required fees are those expenses that are required to be paid with no opt-out option for the tenant. Those things could be something like the tenant being required to have renter's insurance. If there is a required fee for parking, which means that you cannot opt out of not paying, you cannot opt out of having a parking charge, whether you have a car or not. Some properties we've seen have had package locker fees or technology fees, and these are things you cannot choose to say yes or no to. Those become required fees, and then we also include those as a deduction to the maximum gross rent in trying to determine what is affordable. So we have a couple of calculations as to how do we get to what somebody's maximum net rental rate is, and this is what would be in somebody's lease. So we're going to take the maximum gross rent, and so the example here, I have a 1-bedroom unit. So if we're at very low income, the maximum gross rent is $1,628. The utility allowance
that we're saying for this unit is $276, and the required fees are $50, which means the max net rental rate that the property can rent the unit for is $1,302. That's how that is supposed to be calculated. Now, landlords can charge that $1,302, or they can charge you less. It's really up to them. We don't dictate what they charge you. All we dictate is the maximum. But this is how it would be calculated. This is how the calculation is supposed to be done.
Isn't that a lot for a very low income?
$1,302?
Yes. What is the income limit?
$1,000. So for a one bedroom, which means that it's based off of, it could be a 1 to 3 person household.
Mm-hmm.
You could make anywhere $55,950 for a household of one, up to $71,950 for a household of three.
Valerie, this is Ellen. I think I talked with you before. I was telling you one time where I live at Avalon Public Market. I'm in an affordable housing unit, and I talked to the building because they have something here called Conserve. Which is
yeah, that's a third-party billing company.
Right. So mm-hmm. I told them that I didn't want what they call concierge trash because my apartment is two doors away from the trash room. And they mm-hmm. said it didn't matter. I mm-hmm. had to pay for it. And I believe now it's close to $60 a month for trash. And then the other utilities, I mean, I asked them one time, why was my water bill so high? And it was high even when I was gone for a month. I had to pay something like $25, $30. And they told me, or maybe it was you who told me, Valerie, that it goes by the size of the unit and how many people are there.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like affordable housing hasn't really become that affordable anymore. When I moved in, I was paying $26 a month for the third party, and now I pay well over $100 a month for the same services that I had before. And what to do, you just have to go with it.
That unfortunately is that is true. So what you're talking about is like, and I don't have right now what the acronym means, but they call it RUBS. And so when the property is charging for certain services, they're not actually, there's not an actual meter on every single unit. They're taking the entire bill for all the property, and then they divvy it out based off of the square footage usually of their unit or the number of bedrooms.
Right.
But I think we can have as a future agenda item a discussion about that. Alameda County recently has done a survey just on this whole RUBS, and it's become a bigger issue. But what I did want to point out was you talked about your trash, and you can't opt out of your trash, right? So that's a required utility utility you're required to pay. So unfortunately, even though you're paying $60, the utility allowance you get towards trash is $44. And so that's similar to like it's electricity. So for electricity,
right,
we have heating at $37 for a one bedroom, other electric is $65, so that's like what, $91.02? And then your water electricity is another $51.54. I don't know, your PG&E bill may be more or less than that, but you're getting credit for at least $154 for electricity. So some things are going to be more, some things are going to be less. It's not based on what people actually pay. It's based off this formula that is dictated by the federal government, that the housing authorities do this calculation to determine what these utility allowances are. But I think we can, at least at a future date, talk about the utility, like the concern utilities. We can do that.
Right. Well, my PG&E bill isn't small. That's around $100 also a month for a one-bedroom. I don't understand why. I was going to talk to one of the maintenance guys if he could come and check to see. Maybe I have too many things plugged in when I'm not here. I don't know. We'll see.
Rent increases. Because this question comes up a lot. So, there's no rent control in Emeryville. When you don't have rent control, you do not have the authority to limit the amount of rent increases beyond what is in state law. So, the Tenant Protection Act, which was adopted, I think, in 2019, identified a formula that basically says units that were built more than 15 years ago, based off of the area of the region you're in, they can have rent increase 5% plus CPI, not to exceed 10%. So for the current time frame, August 1st, 2025 to July 31st, 2026, the maximum rent increase we can have here in Emeryville is 6.3%. That's state law. Now, units that were built less than 15 years ago are exempt from the state rent cap. There are also some other units that are exempt, like condominiums are exempt.
Are not work exempt? Are live work exempt?
Live work is not an identified category. It would be condominium or greater than 15 years old. 15 years, there's a couple of, but live work would fall within one of the categories. It's not separated. Live work is usually more of a use classification, not a housing type as defined by the state.
So that means that they can, your landlord can raise your rent over 10% or whatever he wants?
But if it's less than 15 years old? If the building is the building less than 15 years old?
No.
If it's more than 15 years old, and then it's 6.3%. If it's less than 15 years old, then they could raise it more than that.
Okay. I was guess I was just trying to say.
If it's a brand new building, they could raise the rent more than 10% or 6.3.
But if it is a live work loss, it will have to
The question will be, is it a condominium or is it multifamily? That's the distinction. Live work doesn't matter. Is it a part of a condominium or is it part of a multifamily property?
It's a multifamily property.
Then if it's more than 15 years old, they can't increase the rent more than right now, 6.3%.
And you said that came into effect what year?
I think it was 2019. The numbers change every year because it's CPI plus 5%. So for the current time frame, it's 6.3%. At one point, over the last couple of years, I know it's gotten up to like 8 point something. It's never gotten to 10, but it has gotten above 8% here in the Bay Area. So that's what the state law says. Between 2023 and 2024, for our published rent limits, we saw the largest increase for our affordable units. And that was approximately 7% just based off of what the maximum rent that somebody could charge is. So in 2003, between 24, there was a $78 increase for very low-income one-bedroom units and a $172 increase for moderate-income one-bedroom units. The lowest rent increase is where we currently are today. Between 2025 and 2026, we are seeing approximately a 2% rent increase.
Because of inflation.
Hold on a second. So for a one-bedroom unit at very low, that would equate to a $30 rent increase, and for a one-bedroom moderate, a $66 increase. And I say all that with a caveat. A landlord still cannot raise rent more than the maximum gross rent. And I say that with the caveat because if you are not currently paying the maximum and your landlord increases your rent up to the current maximum, it could be greater than that 2% that we're seeing right now. And a lot of times when we do get called, and that's when that 6.3 would kick in. We get calls, you know, my rent went up, you know, X amount. Well, you weren't being charged the maximum previously, and now they've decided to not only do an increase, but maybe go up to the maximum. They still can't, you know, so that's where you got to look at both numbers. Mm-hmm. But 6.3% is what the Tenant Protection Act says for units more than 15 years old, but you still can't go over, irregardless, whatever our maximum rent limits are.
And this chart just kind of shows you going back from 22 every year, kind of what the difference is. You see 25 to 26 is the smallest delta. Okay, so now onto the affordable ownership housing assumptions. In order for us to determine our maximum resale price on our ownership side, we look at a variety of assumptions. And I will say that going with our consultant, I realized there were some errors in the calculation, so a couple of the numbers are going to change. So for moderate income units, the state defines affordable housing again. Instead of 30 like it does for rental, it's 35% of 110% of AMI for moderate income units. When we look at our interest rates to determine affordability, we look at the past 13-week average from Freddie Mac for a 30-year interest rate over a 90-day period. And every time somebody comes to us looking to sell the house, we then recalculate it again. For private mortgage insurance, our PMI is 0.65% when there is actually PMI to be charged on that loan. Property taxes were at 0.1% of the affordable sales price. We actually use the actual homeowner association fees associated with that unit when we're calculating it. In our chart, we're doing an averaging, but for every individual unit, we actually look at what they actually pay. The utility allowance, we use the same information that came from the housing authority based on the number of bedrooms. For homeowners insurance, this number will change in the future. There was a study that the state did back in 2017, and that is the most recent study. Last year, we took that and we added 20% for inflation. We took last year's number and added another 10% for inflation. What we are seeing is a huge range of what homeowners' insurance premiums are, ranging from $30 a month up to $120 a month. Like, it's a huge range. What our calculation is doing right now is putting us in the middle, but on the slightly higher end, because we see that numbers are trending up. And then last year, you guys voted to do a 15% affordability factor for studios and one bedrooms to ensure that there's a discount from the market rate, because we were seeing that our affordable, using all these assumptions and calculating what could be affordable, our prices were right next to market. And so if you have the choice of buying a unit that had all these requirements on how you could sell it, who you could sell it for, or buying one on the market, you're going to buy the one on the market for our units for sitting. So you guys agreed last year to do a 15% affordability factor. And then in our assumption, we always assume that the home buyer is bringing 5% in down payment assistance. Before I go into the numbers, I'm going to give you just a little history on what we've seen over the last year and a half or so. So we sold three units in between 2025 and today. Only three. We are really trending down. We had one unit at Glass House. It's a one bedroom, one bath. It originally listed for $379 in December of 25 and sold for $369 in March of 26. We had a two bedroom, three bath at City Limits, originally listed for $482,000 in April of 25, sold for $482 in August of 25. And then at View 46, we had a two bedroom, two bath, originally listed at $507,200 in February, sold in May. So as you can see, our two bedrooms, they sell at what we list them at because they truly are affordable compared to the market. But our one bedroom had to take a discount on what they originally listed it for. Now, that original listing price was not even the maximum affordable resale price. It was actually higher than that. But they actually dropped it down and then did another deduction to actually make it sell. We currently have on the unit one bedroom, one bath at Andante. This unit originally listed for $329 in March of 2025. That's how long it's been on the market. It is currently listed for $235,000, and that listing price changed at the end of May.
There are a lot of reasons why Andante is not selling.
Absolutely. There are a lot of reasons that the Andante specifically. But for comparison, there is a market rate listing at Andante for $330,000 today. That went on the market in March, and there was a market rate unit that sold on Andante, also one bedroom, one bath, sold for $275,000 in August of 25. So I just wanted to give you guys those comparisons so you can see how our one bedroom specifically are relating to the market. And then at Terraces, we have a one bedroom, one bath, originally listed It's on the market for three. Actually, they just dropped it. So it was on the market for $345,000. They just did a reduction yesterday, dropping it $10,000 to $335,000. There is another one-bedroom, one-bath on the market currently at $550,000. I will say, while they're both one-bedrooms, square footage size is completely different. Mm-hmm. Our unit is 600 and something square feet. The other one is over 1,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. There was another market sale that happened in December of 25 that sold for $411,000. This one might sit a little bit too. So that's kind of what we've seen over the past year. And I'm going to show you the problem unit we've had. We have a one bedroom, one bath listing that originally listed for $441,600 in September of 2024. That was the maximum BMR resale price. The owner dropped the price to $439,000 in December, dropped the price again in December to $435,000, removed the property from the market in February because it just wasn't, they weren't getting any hits. They then relisted it at $410,000 in July of 25, dropped the price in August down to $399,000, removed the property again from the market in October because they weren't getting any hits. Relisted it in March of 26 for that same $399 price and then removed it again from the market in May. So what have been the issues with this one? One, the buyer believes they should be able to sell their unit for the maximum BMR sales price. And mm-hmm. So we had to push them to drop the price because they were not getting any offers. And the unit was just sitting out there picking up. The unit's priced way too close to the market rate prices that are in the area. And the buyer has not been aggressive in reducing the price or reviewing the downward market trends. The last thing, we had another BMR unit come on the market in the same building, priced, and they priced their unit $30,000 below the other unit that had been sitting on the market for over a year. None of the units sold in 4 months. And this one is still out there.
Okay. So are they having to pay HOA fees this whole time? Mm-hmm.
And their mortgage, and they're not living there.
And their mortgage, and their taxes, and their insurance, and they don't see how that's not smart to do. Over. Okay. That's curious.
And when you say they're not living there, is this part of the, like, making an effort to sell it? Because I thought you guys had some...
You do. You have to live in the unit for 10 months. And if you don't, then you have to pay off your loan, or we have to encourage you to sell it. Mm-hmm. Well, they... For whatever reason, they needed to move, and so they did, and they put their unit on the market, and it won't sell. Now, we can't – they already have it on the market, so there's nothing we can do outside of tell them, you need to sell it. They're fine. And just – but they're not being aggressive and wanting to drop the price.
You don't think you can tell us where the unit is?
That glass house.
Just curious.
Oh, the glass house was the one that they sold it for $30,000 less, which is why it only was there for 4 months. The units were identical. But two units in the building, two totally different prices, want to buy the more affordable one. So I bring all that up to say, here's our estimated maximum resale calculation. And what I'm providing to you guys here on this top line is what it is without the affordability factor. So a one bedroom, we would tell them they could list it for $427,000. If we did include the 15% affordability factor, it would drop the price to $378,000. If we increased it to 30%, it would drop the price to $339,000. And so it's one of our questions that I have for you guys today is, one, do you guys want to continue doing the affordability factor, and do you want to keep it at 15, or do you want to consider going to 30?
That's a nice question.
That brings me to the end of my presentation. This is all the different numbers all together, and then I'm going to, now we can go to questions.
So I'm just curious, like, besides the obvious where the homeowner is making money off of their sale, is that possible? I thought with Myanmar homeownership, when you go to sell, it's like you have to...
We restrict the sales price. That's the affordable resale price.
That's the only restriction.
And we restrict who it can be sold to. But when a unit is on the market, I believe it's for over 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I think it might go to 9 months. at some point we can, the city can remove the income restrictions. So no longer are you required to sell it to an affordable home buyer. You're still required to sell it at an affordable sales price, but there's no income restrictions on who can buy it. And that has been removed for that unit. It's for over a year. And they're still not getting any hits.
So anybody can buy it?
Anybody can buy it. Outside of somebody who wants to turn it into a rental property, they still have to live there as an owner-occupant. And then that homeowner is still restricted when they want to sell it as to what it can be sold for, who they can sell it for, but the requirement that they be low income or moderate income is no longer there on this unit.
Was it originally what they originally purchased it for?
Less than $300,000 back in 2008.
So now that opportunity for low income home buyers is being open to everybody with a big fee.
It's open to everybody. Anybody could bid on the property. But when it was restricted, nobody was bidding on it either. When it was, and it's restricted, like I said, I believe it's like 9 months it's restricted. And then after that, it's our determination. The city can make the determination to remove it so that it can, they can try to sell it, but they're still not good.
But so what do you think the reasons could be? Because if it's at a restricted lower price than market rate and anyone can buy it, and it's just the market's that bad, like there's just no buyers.
Well, I think,
we
calculate affordability on what somebody can afford to pay. The problem is, in this market, there are a lot of units in Emeryville on the market for less than $350,000 that are not BMR units. So why would somebody buy our BMR unit at $399 when you can get a unit at Watergate for less than that or on another property? I think that's the problem.
You can't get financing in Watergate.
Well, maybe not. Maybe Watergate's a bad example, but price-wise, I think that's part of it. That the market right now, there's not a lot of inventory, and you can get a unit at a similar price that is not restricted for somewhere close.
So it's, I mean, the glass house presumably is generally just a higher rate than, say, Watergate or something like that. You're saying?
Oh, yeah, their two bedrooms go for much more. The two bedrooms sell, no problem. It's our one bedrooms and studios that we're having issues with. Separate from the issues of HOA issues or being able to get financing, the pricing is just not working. It's not attracting enough people.
Is it really market rate that you're facing? I mean, is it really below market rate? If it's like the market has lower rate stock available?
No, I mean, you're absolutely correct. Our pricing is based off of what would be affordable to somebody at that income. Unfortunately, the market has dropped so much that our prices are now not below market.
So it's based on affordability, not
based
on the market.
Based on affordability.
Okay.
Why have the prices dropped so much?
In the market? I think just inflation. I think it's just an inflation issue. And there's just not a lot of inventory on the market. Which sometimes will drive prices up, but in this market, it's driving prices down.
I'm curious why there's so much, like, allowance for profit off of these homes when they're supposed to be for, like, stability, right? Why is there so much room for someone to hold on to that property for such a huge gain? And the intention is, I mean, maybe the intention is not for...
They still bought it. And when you buy a home, you intend to make a profit off of it. I think in this market in California, we saw huge price increases. So this same unit, during COVID, probably would have sold for $450, no problem. And people would have bought it at an affordable income. But the fact that back in 2008, real estate wasn't as high as it is today. It was actually at foreclosure, so prices had really dropped. This unit just hit the market at a really low sales price, and the market has changed. Just like if you were anywhere else and you bought a unit, you want to be able to appreciate some of that gain. But unfortunately, you have to work with the market. So maybe you bought it at a low price, and when time comes, the market drops, and you're not getting a huge profit. And maybe you wait at the right time and you do get a. We can't control that. What we do control is who it can be sold to, and what we do is restrict the sales price to something that could be affordable to somebody at a certain income level.
Mm-hmm.
There also is some of the properties have some profit sharing in the agreements,
mm-hmm.
so we share in the profit,
mm-hmm.
But they all don't. And so a lot of our homeowners also have first-time homebuyer loans from the city
mm-hmm.
to help make it more affordable. And in those cases, we get paid off of our loan as well. But we don't take any profit back from the sale of a BMR. We're just trying to restrict it so that another affordable person could potentially get a new unit. And when it's been on the market for over a year, we can't restrict it anymore.
Yeah. I would think that the BMR homeownership is less about making gains off the property. Even though it's hard.
Their gains are restricted. In a different market, their gains would be restricted.
You're still buying it. Like you're not renting it. So like they could just don't just be renting it. They could make any gains off of it. Like that's what's why you buy it. That is so that you gain equity, but
we have some people who have told us, you know, they bought during COVID and when the prices were high. And now if they wanted to sell, they're underwater. Mm-hmm. They cannot sell. This person is at a different situation because they bought it when it was first built.
Mm-hmm.
Their mortgage, you know, it's been almost 20 years that they've been paying on their mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
But the prices just then were completely different, that they're going to be able to realize a totally different amount on their unit than someone who bought it 4 years
mm-hmm.
ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so like it seems like what this program is doing is it guarantees you an affordable price when you purchase the property, but then it can't protect you completely from the market.
Yeah.
It's an investment that's still subject to the market.
Just like anybody else. And some people hit it at the right time and you get a good payoff, and other people are like, wait, I'm underwater now. I just bought this unit and now it's worth less than what I bought it for. You know, that is the case for some people because the market's just gone down. So the question is, do you guys want to recommend that we continue to include the 15% affordability factor in determining the affordable sales prices for studios and one bedrooms? And then would you recommend City Council adopt the affordable housing table?
Can you explain the 15% affordability factor?
Yeah. That goes back to this page. So what it does is it takes 15%. And you can't see it, but it's 15% off of, actually, you can. It's 15% off of the sales price is how you get here. 30% off of the sales price is how you get down here.
So that's for the buyer.
That's for the buyer would buy the studio at $299
yeah.
instead of the $376. At $339 instead of the $427. If we went 30%. If we keep it how we've been doing last year, this is where we would be. And I believe last year, staff recommendation actually was to go to the higher level, but I think the committee felt sticking at something a little bit more, splitting the baby was the better option. Because they didn't want to depress the market by dropping prices too low. They wanted to ensure people have the ability of getting something on the resale. So we did 15% last year. And so just asking you guys what you guys would like. And the council would took your recommendation and actually moved forward with it that way.
So now because the one bedrooms are so and the studios are so close, because the market rate is so low, it doesn't look like a discount.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't feel like a discount.
Which is why units are sitting longer.
Sure.
Unless the homeowner decides on their own to say, I know this is what you're saying I can, I'm going to drop it. For so many years, whatever we list as the affordable sales price, every unit sold exactly at that price.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're seeing people are having to do price reductions and take less.
What can you split the, can you go like 25 instead of 30 and, or like 22?
We can do whatever you guys would recommend.
Then how long does it stay in place? Or is there a decision made every year?
Every year. We'll decide again next year.
Those are the new maximums
yes.
after the application of the stabilization. So if someone, see the thing is, and it would just be for this year, because if the market changes again, And this might not make sense.
Right. So last year what you guys did was you wanted it to be reevaluated in 6 months.
Oh, yeah.
And things got worse. It didn't get better, so we left the 15% off.
We can be established in 6 months.
That's what you guys had asked. Yeah, absolutely. If you'd like to do it that way.
Because the problem is, like, if the market gets better, because people who bought at the higher rate, you know, those are affordable people too, and they're selling at a lower rate. They're capable of being forced to take a loss.
Yeah.
Right. But that keeps the property moving, right? Mm-hmm. It does, like, if you know, someone else can get it, but like, it does force them to take a loss, and that only makes sense in certain market conditions. So if the market changes, then you would want to be able to reevaluate so that you're not forcing the original homeowners to take a loss.
Exactly. And I'll just put this back on the table. So this unit at Andante that has been able to drop it to 235, the reason they were able to drop it that low is because there's a city loan on the property. They need to sell the property. I can take a loss on my loan. And so what we had to do on this one, because these people, they don't live here anymore. They live in another country. Mm-hmm. And they're struggling. Like, what are we supposed to do? And so we calculated, okay, you have these city loans. One of them we can accept less. The other one we can't, the way the loan was written. So if we took zero on that other loan, what could you drop the price to? And that's how we came up with this, mm-hmm. to see if it'll help them get some traction. And actually, since they did this, we've actually received, we have two people who are interested, trying to determine whether or not, you know, it'll work. But we have two people who have expressed interest now, because the unit's now on the market for $235.
But you can't apply.
But that's also a walk to the city.
There's a lot of reasons that they shouldn't pay more than that for that building. Mm-hmm. Like the HOA fees are going up 15% per year.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. They're going up 15% per year according to their
Because they don't have any reserves at all.
None.
Is there an algorithm that can dictate, like, as far as like when the market goes down and whether you're selling, that 15% factor or whatever is decided, 15 or 30, vacillates as depending on like when you decide to sell, because it has to balance. It can't just be like, wow, the market went down and it's 30% off or it's 50. Isn't there like, can you do like 7.5 because the market went down this many points? And it, you know what I mean? Like, so it can do that. But then you do have loans that they're stated as a certain thing. But you know what? That's kind of like, that's just the way it is. And the interest rate is the interest rate. And okay, but that's better than,
And a lot of times we'll get inquiries from people who are looking to sell. They want us to calculate what the price is so that they can determine if they want to list it for sale. Mm-hmm. And so then a lot of people say, well, no, not quite yet. I want to wait a few more months mm-hmm. to see. Which is perfectly fine. I think the challenge is if we keep changing the formula, they're going to question, why did it change so rapidly?
Can the formula be in action at the moment of sale?
So the things that we do pick up that are in action is the interest rate. So we used to set it at the start of the year, and then we started seeing big changes in how the interest rate was moving. So we decided every 90 days. And we tell our homeowners now, we will reissue you a maximum price at every 90 days related to the sale. If it's not moving, we'll have to recalculate it for you. So we do that. And then what's the other one? Interest rate. Oh, and then the actual HOAs. So with Andante's prices being so high, that's why those one bedrooms are more affordable than you'll see at another property that has a one bedroom, because we're calculating in their high HOA fee and determining a homeowner is not just paying a mortgage, they got to pay HOA fees too. So what is that mortgage rate plus HOA fee combined? How do we make it affordable? Well, it needs to sell for much less because they're charging so much on the HOA side.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the other reason why apartments, it's across the board, one bedrooms are one bedrooms, but on the ownership side, the HOA fee differs so drastically that you can have one bedroom and one property that sells for
mm-hmm.
one price, and a completely other property across town is able to sell for so much more because their HOA fees aren't as high.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to clarify one thing. You were saying that you do basically require a drop in price after 90 days?
We don't require a drop in price. What happens is I believe they have, it's 180 days they have to list the property. After 180 days, the city will then assist in doing some additional marketing of that unit. Now, when they market that unit, there are certain things we do require them to do. It has to be listed. You have to have pictures. It has to be on MLS. You have to have an open house or an availability for people to come and view.
Yeah.
We will review the MLS. We started reviewing MLS listings. And we'll tell people, like, you're not selling. You're not putting the best foot forward in trying to sell this unit. You know, there's so many opportunities to do virtual staging. Do the virtual staging. Let people see how you can live in the unit. So we will do those things, give them that advice. If we see that they're not including certain information on the MLS, we tell them that they've got to correct it. And then we will start saying if it's not moving, like, you may want to consider a price drop. So we do give those recommendations. Ultimately, it's the homeowner's decision.
Right.
But we try to get them and the agent to understand you can continue to sit on this unit. And guess what? I know what else is on the market here, and the agent should be telling you this.
Right.
This unit's not going to sell when there's another unit out there.
So that's something, like, can the affordability factor be, like, graduated affordability factor that, like, could be imposed over time? Like, you start at the, you know, at the maximum size based on affordability. It doesn't sell when you're really trying, according to all the criteria you just said, in, I don't know, 6 months, then you apply the affordability factor at 15%. It doesn't. Within, however many months.
I don't think we can do that, only because our resale restriction doesn't have that language in it. Uh-huh. What it does say is you will sell it for the no greater than the maximum affordability price,
mm-hmm.
and that is calculated by us in this body at City Council.
Nice.
So that's why we're trying to put it here. There's only so much push, and ultimately it is the homeowner is still having to pay that mortgage. I just hate the unit sitting there for so long.
Yeah.
We try to encourage them, but I can't force them to sell their house for less than they want to sell it for.
And I think what would be, don't even include the HOAs. The HOAs is a totally different site. That's we can't govern that. We have no, it doesn't, people will buy something. Either they'll be happy with the HOA fees or they'll be not so happy, but they still bought it. Or they'll be in a situation where they have it, they love it. And they go up, HOAs go up all the time. That's just the way it is. So taking that out of the equation and just sticking with the, okay, affordable, then the affordable stabilization factor, I just think that is, the market is a living thing. The affordable stabilization factor should be a living thing in tandem with it, not just something that's just like loan.
I'm okay with putting it at 30% and coming up to it in 6 months if then somebody else is
like, okay. But also, if you did the 30% the rate, that's just like what they can do. To your point,
yeah.
Valerie, right? It doesn't mean it doesn't mean that the seller has to, right? You can use the 30% and then you can be in that same predicament as that other scenario.
Right. Well, what happened if we agree to the 30%, we would tell them this is the maximum. We would do their calculation. Potentially, this could be the calculation, and then they couldn't sell it for more than this.
Got it.
Okay.
Mm.
Even though it's already on the market?
Not that unit.
Oh.
If a unit came to us, we would do all the calculations, and potentially this would be what the maximum resale price would be for that unit.
Got it. Okay.
If we did it the other way. Now, they always can drop it, but they won't be able to go back up. This would be the ceiling.
Okay.
So what are we accomplishing by making it that low?
You move the property so someone else can actually take it. It's not just sitting on the market for a long period of time.
Which is why probably last year we came to the compromise of the 15%.
Yeah,
so not down to
30%. So you were saying that, like, I think you were hinting in this direction that, like, certain types of units Was it one bedroom studios or harder to move than
the studios and the one bedrooms?
Do we have the option of applying a different affordability stabilization factor to different categories?
Well, yeah. So we didn't apply affordability stabilization factor to two or three bedrooms at all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Only to the one and the studio.
Thank you. Just clarify for us, like, which are the ones that are the hardest ones to move? Is one bedroom?
We have not seen a studio in a while, okay. But definitely get a lot of one bedrooms, and those are having a challenge moving. But when we've seen, it's been a minute since we have had a studio, but the prices of studios on the market are also really low.
What's the advantage of, or what is it reasonable to say, okay, do the affordable stabilization, whatever is decided, but it's not open market. It has to be for people with low income. You can't be.
No. There's a resale restriction agreement, and that requirement is built into the resale restriction agreement. We cannot change what's reported against the property. So after so many days, the city has the option. The city council has lended that option to staff. And so after whatever it is, 9 months or a year, we remove it. There's no reason if nobody who meets the income requirements is interested in buying it, you're only hurting that homeowner even more by restricting it who they can sell it to. There's somebody else that wants to buy it, but they're over income. At least let somebody get in that unit. The unit's still a part of our portfolio. They still have to certify that they live in the unit. When they want to sell the unit again, they have to sell it to somebody who's at a certain income level again. So the restriction lives on the property, but there's a point in time where we allow somebody over that income, if we can't find an affordable homeowner to buy it, we allow it to be sold to somebody else.
You have to live in it 10 months?
10 months out of the year.
Okay, but doesn't the sales price, I know there's like an income limit, right? But like, let's say it's 80% AMI. So that's like $80,000, or it was.
95% of our portfolio for homeownership is at 120, which is why I'm only showing you the 100.
Well, I'm just saying, for example, that is not the only thing that affects the income. Like, you still have to have your high end ratio and your back end ratio and all this mm-hmm. stuff. So that could still mean lowering the price makes the pool smaller, right?
No. Because your ratios, you then, so when you lower, so let's see, where's the row? Mortgage amount. So this is the mortgage amount based off of this sales price.
Mm-hmm.
If this sales price was listed, this mortgage amount would go down, which means somebody would be able to have a very low front end ratio. Because their income compared to what they're paying in monthly mortgage is much lower. So the lower the sales price or the lower down payment, it actually drops your front end ratios. It doesn't address your back end ratios, which have to do with your own debt, which the sales price has nothing to do with that.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, the money comes from a gift in cash?
Where that 5% comes, there's rules related to that, but we just put it in there as a standard. Somebody might be contributing more than 5%, but our assumption always is that there's a 5% coming.
Did you say that 90 or 95% of the
homeownership portfolio?
GMR homeownership portfolio, is it 120%?
Moderate income.
Mm-hmm. That's why I think that it should be lower, people can have more access to the units. By having a listing, it does limit access to the unit.
Well, I mean, even when the price drops, somebody at 80 could always buy it.
Yeah. No, that's why I'm for it.
They could buy it. Yeah, and the lower it is, somebody at 80 could buy it if they wanted to. And in fact, so this again, this chart is assuming no affordability factor. So that one bedroom with no affordability factor, that was 378, an 80% of affordable unit, the price would need to be at $172,000 for somebody at that income for us to call it affordable. Now, we have had people at 80% buy moderate rate units because they're getting down payment or other things. So it's happened even at the higher sales price.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, these are effective July 1st, 2026.
It will be adopted by council on the 7th, but it's technically effective July 1st. That's when the law says that they're effective.
And so we're trying to decide if we want to keep it at 15%.
Right. So I'm just, yeah, so that I can update the chart. So whether or not we're going to no affordability factor or do the 15, or if you guys want to reconsider doing the 30.
I say the 15.
And it could be 15 for a one-bedroom, 30 for a two, or something like that?
Nothing. We're not recommending anything for a two- or three-bedroom. At the affordable price. It's only for a studio and a one-bedroom.
Only for stuff. Okay, got it.
So you could do, like, 15 for the studio and 30 for a bedroom? Or does it need to be the same?
It's easier to keep it the same, not have different formulas. Besides, if we did what you just mentioned, the studio would be $333,000 and the one bedroom would be
$339,000.
Yeah,
I think
that.
I'm not. I like both.
$330,000.
Yeah, from
15.
Yeah.
Just to follow up on what Wendy was saying before.
I think we're almost at 7.
Okay.
We're going to need the full hour.
One thing I did like about what we did last meeting, even though I've forgotten it, was that we said we would want to revisit this within a year and see if things have changed. And clearly they've gotten worse, or at least not changed. But is there, like, can we do the same if whatever we recommend?
You can recommend it that way. Mm-hmm.
Can we recommend something like, I guess it doesn't matter to get to a more detailed recommendation, but I was going to say, like, if the market rate for a one bedroom, you know, gets to a certain point, we would recommend that future us or whoever is here, like, would reconsider the 30% if we went to like 30% or something. Is that?
You got, yeah, absolutely. You could recommend it.
That's the only way I can think of to
recommend
the market change.
I probably would stick with the 15. I really wanted the 30 last year, but I think since we've done the 15, I think sticking with that probably is the safest. And then a reassessing. I would recommend the reassessment.
Do you think if you did 30, like just based off of what you've seen, do you feel like that would make homeowners go into a loss?
Yes. Homeowners that have bought within the past 5 years, absolutely.
And you think there's a lot of homeowners selling that have purchased in the last 5 years?
We've actually had a couple that have that bought in COVID, and we've had somebody.
Why did they end up selling? I'm just curious. I
don't recall. We've had people who have moved. Family situations have changed. Maybe. People have passed away. Job has taken them somewhere else. There's been a lot of reasons we've had people, yeah.
I'm for 15% also. I still feel like a year isn't like, yes, there hasn't been movement, but that's not been like a significant amount of time to say, like, let's drop it 15 more percent down, as opposed to, Brooke, your point of like maybe giving it a little bit more time, and then in 6 months, be like, okay, we've given it like, we have like more data, and now let's move forward with something a bit more.
What is 20?
We need a
motion. Motion
for 15%.
Okay, I just said there's no chance of putting another number like 20 or 22 or it's just 15 or 30.
Oh, I mean, no, you can recommend a different number.
Well, who recommended 30? Those numbers was one.
Our consultant.
Oh, I see. Okay. So that's they have.
They went and looked at all the market data last year, and that's why they had recommended 30. They were like, our prices are too close to market. They were like, you really need to get to 30% if you really want to see units move and for people to feel like they're getting something below market.
Okay.
That's why they came up with the 30%.
Mm-hmm.
They are out of town, so they weren't able to pull all the data for me. So that's why I said, we'll just recommend it again. But we do know what at least has happened.
And the consultant only looked at 1 year of data.
Last year, I think they looked I think they looked at, yeah, and they looked at what was on the, what was happening in the market and the sales. And they had identified last year that inventory was getting less and less. There were less and less sales. We haven't closed our first-time homebuyer loan since, I think, February.
Mm-hmm.
We have homeowners that are out there who have letters to use the money, but the inventory is not there, which is why they're not buying. And they could use that money on these units if they wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine that 235, and then you got $200,000, $35,000 mortgage, which mm-hmm. nobody probably would ever give you, but...
How many people got to use the home buyer program?
I think we have closed 6 loans.
No. Yeah.
So I think we heard, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So Jen made a motion. And then who seconded? Did anybody second it?
Did you have a reassessment time period as part of your motion?
Oh, what do you like?
6 months?
I think 6 months. A year? Yeah, I think 6 months.
Second.
Wait for me to call? No.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, I'm going. Vice Chair Hill?
Aye.
Member Oakley?
Yes.
Member Drummond?
We can not vote, right?
You can abstain or you can say no.
Abstain. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Member Majerus and Member... Thank you, guys. All right, go to the next presentation. And I'm sorry, Ellen, you didn't vote. Did she just drop off?
Well, is she there?
No, she did. She dropped off.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully she'll call back. All right. Let me go to the next presentation. See that?
We did a vote to adopt the
I'm sorry.
Housing table.
Thank you. I forgot. And do you guys want to adopt the table? I forgot. That's the second part of the action.
Well,
or we could make it all in one. You guys want to adopt the table with a 15% affordable, with a 15% affordability factor that will be reassessed in 6 months. We'll make, is that okay, making that the motion?
Yes. Yeah.
The rent table was on there and the income limit. Thank you, Robert. Okay. Tenant protection. So we finally got our policy and programmatic recommendations. We have turned this into a two-phase project. Phase one is what we originally started off with, looking at our tenants' rights to organize, modifying our just cause and no-call restrictions, relocation payment, right to return, modifying our anti-harassment restrictions, and complying with our tenant protection policies under the transit-oriented program, of which we received a grant to help us work on this work. Phase two will be what we talked about. Say that again? Thank you. Ellen, are you there?
Okay, now I am. I got...
Okay, I was like, you disappeared.
Yeah, I know. I was like, what's going on? Yeah, I'm still here now.
Okay.
I'm back.
Thank you. And then phase two will be our temporary relocation assistance policy, which we talked about at the last meeting. So phase one timeline, we started back in August of 2025. We had our agreement with our contractor, Placeworks. We did our outreach. They've given us a draft assessment of our local tenant protection ordinance and kind of what's there. And best practices. They've given us a draft analysis of eviction trends, and they've also given us a report of all the community outreach that they've done. And so then they submitted us the recommendations in May, and so that's why we are here today, having you guys opine on some of these recommendations. We are going to go to the Economic Development and Advisory Committee. We found out that back in 2016, the city did do that because it does impact landlords, which is a business. So that's why we're also taking the information to them. And then we are looking to go to city council to do a study session in September. But we will be presenting the recommendations to them, all of the community outreach and the feedback from these two committees. Once we get that feedback, we will come back to this committee, hopefully in October. If not October, it will be November, and bring the draft ordinance and then go to city council for the first reading in November and hopefully to have it adopted in December. It is a very tight timetable. This is what we are proposing. The schedule has been modified several times and we already recognize this may not happen this quickly. Depending upon the amount of feedback we get, we may not be able to get the ordinance completely drafted and modified to come back to you in less than 30 days. So the schedule might get pushed out to after the first of the year. But this is what our goal is. For phase two, we're trying to keep them aligned the same, but we started a little bit later. So our intention is to come back to you guys at our next meeting, whether that's July or August, we'll talk about that later, and provide you recommendations related to our temporary relocation assistance. And then again, city council in September, back to you guys in October, and then hopefully it'll follow the same. So now down to the recommendations. There were 16 recommendations. So the first one, set a minimum amount for non-payment of rent or utility payment. The reason this is being recommended is because over 1,500 of our notices to terminate were issued for non-payment of rent. I mean, that's like 95% of the notices we get is for non-payment of rent. 268 of those notices were actually for less than $1,000. We actually do get notices related to utilities. I've seen them for like what, $3? I mean,
like $5
or
something like that.
So the thought is to setting a minimum amount of unpaid rent can prevent pretextual evictions based on nominal amounts. Surprisingly, there are four other cities that do this,
mm-hmm.
and it has been challenged in the courts, and the cities won.
Mm-hmm.
So, City of Los Angeles, Los Angeles County, Berkeley, and Oakland have all adopted this policy. So that is our recommendation, to require non-payment of rent must be equal to 1 month of fair market rent as determined by HUD in order to issue a 3-day notice of termination. And staff is recommending that this is one of the policies we submit to City Council. Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Information item, right? So you don't need anything from us.
We want your feedback.
Okay.
So that we can go to council.
Okay.
Yeah. So if there's something on here you don't like, you tell us.
Yeah.
So that we know what we can tell council what your thoughts are.
So far, so good.
So far, so good.
Yeah. So that means that you can evict somebody after 30 days when 1 month of rent's owed.
Yeah, but what it would do is prevent somebody from being evicted just because they didn't pay their utilities or they didn't pay the late fee.
Why is it being bundled like that? It's two different things.
Because a lot of people pay the utilities, like the conserve, they pay it to the landlord. So it's a part of the total rent that's owed is that utility component and the rent, just like whatever the service charge they may have. It's all owed to the landlord, and they could issue you an eviction notice for non-payment of any of those mm-hmm. required fees.
Like right now, there's no protection. If you owe them $5, they can evict you.
Yeah.
But I just feel like letting someone get that far behind on their utilities is going to be, I mean, like, bad for them. Like,
1 month, I think it's fair.
1 month of rent, that's not the same.
Well, and it's not electricity, because that is not billed through the landlord. That's, you pay that bill directly to PG&E. You have a contract with them.
Mm-hmm.
This would be the utilities for the whole property. So a lot of times the water, the trash,
mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's pest control. Those are the things that are the utilities that you pay to the landlord.
My rent was all utilities were included. What happens then? Same thing.
If they're paying all the utilities on your behalf,
that doesn't apply.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because you don't pay any utilities anyway, so it doesn't matter.
It's just saying a dollar amount, right? Not,
yeah.
It's not saying actual, the dollar amount has
right.
to be allotted to rent
right.
correct.
Category only. It's just saying if your unit is $2,500, including whatever that means, that's the amount right?
But it's a fair market rent.
Yeah.
So let's say that a fair market rent for a one bedroom is $1,800. What it's saying is, if you owe less than $1,800, mm-hmm. they cannot evict you. You owe $1,800 or more, they can.
No matter if it's electricity rent,
mm-hmm.
dog
exactly.
rent, whatever it is.
And just to clarify, the policy recommended, is that the threshold that all of these other cities are using?
All of them, except for Los Angeles County, which actually does 2 months of fair market rent. But everybody else does one.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My only concern is that usually if you have something steady, a job or an income or gifts, a trust, whatever it is, and you're using that money, and usually very close to 30 days or at 30 days, shit can hit the fan. Something cannot come through. The check didn't come, the this, the that, the blah, blah, blah. Now it's going to take another 2 weeks, and then this and that. And it needs to be a little bit longer than the month goes. Because stuff will usually go awry in 30 days. And then in 31, they start conviction process?
So think of it this way. If rent is due July 1st.
Right.
And you're late after the 3rd, right?
Yeah.
If you don't, but let's say your rent is $2,000. Yeah. The fair market rent is $1,800. You're over that limit.
Right.
Which means that they can actually issue you a notice like they would be able to today.
Right.
But let's say that your rent is $1,500. Mm-hmm. They would not be able to issue you an eviction, a 3-day notice. They would have to wait until you owed them more than $1,800 in order to do it.
So mm-hmm. the next month.
Yeah. So there's a very small delta between I regularly pay to, oh my gosh, something happened.
I mean, the day something happened, they yeah. issue you a notice. In 3 days.
So. Yeah. I think it's better than nothing.
I mean, I feel like this policy is definitely important, mm-hmm. but also I feel like there's policy around like safety net funds that can help people pay these bills that are more important for us to focus on than anything else. Like, you know, I mean, changing what a landlord can and cannot do is according to I don't know, this could also hurt the landlord. I know that nobody wants to hear that, but it's true. And I just feel like the focus should be on how I don't get this paid as opposed to, like, penalizing the landlord. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
What are there,
like, a perfect world, though, and a separate issue?
From a landlord perspective, I get that. Like,
mm-hmm.
I mean,
that's why we say get to eat it, get there.
It could be months of, like, not paying utilities that, you know, mm-hmm. that's still under, like, 1 month rent. And, like, you know, that then becomes, like, a crazy scenario or, like, how are they going to catch up with that? Yeah, I kind of get that. I guess what I don't understand is, like, why, like, for non-payment of, like, utilities, like, the enforcement tool is eviction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just, like, you know, nuclear option, like, based on, like, I mean, are there other enforcement tools that, like, a landlord could use? I'm just trying to think from a landlord perspective, like, how could you enforce, like, payment of utilities without
going through
that? Another contract. Why can those two not be held separate?
Yeah. You know, if somebody's behind on their utilities for 4 months, then they shouldn't be able to be evicted for that. But if they're 2 months behind on rent, like that, you know what I mean? Like, it should be two separate issues.
They can't.
So we don't have all of our landlords do it. It's an interesting conundrum.
Mm-hmm.
Only certain landlords will do it for utilities.
Only the big landlords.
No. Now, even amongst the big landlords, they all do not do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's only some landlords. I don't know if you recall how many.
Yeah.
But it's not. All of our landlords don't do it.
Every affordable housing building I know does it.
It's tenant protection is the point of the,
mm-hmm.
the policy that we're creating there. The purpose is to protect the tenants because there is, it's statistically, you know, there's been an imbalance of power. That's why we're looking to implement things like these things. And so I think it is important to take that into consideration. It's It's not like we're just making it up that there's an imbalance.
Mm-hmm.
That's why these other neighboring cities have implemented the policy. So I think that we should also.
Yeah, I'll be in that same camp. One question, couldn't the landlord, like, if you didn't pay, let's say your rent is lower than fair market rent, and you didn't, if you could make the rent for 1 month, and it's like a $200 difference, couldn't the landlord charge like a fee that would push it over the edge or something?
Like, oh, yeah, they would charge you a fee.
And could that push it over the threshold? Or because then they would owe, then you would owe more.
Maybe we're that close, I guess, technically, yeah.
I guess fees are probably limited in certain ways, if I remember correctly. As well.
I think the state.
They're usually also always, like, generally listed in your lease. Beforehand, so I can't just make up a number
right.
And penalize you.
Yeah.
I think that's also part of Oakland tenant descriptions. It's like just not allowing people to make up things that can penalize
you. I'm going to move on to the second one because we've got 45 minutes and I got 15 to go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, 15?
15 more policies to go. Number two. Staff is not recommending this policy, but this came from our consultant. To allow notices to terminate tenancy be issued where tenants in affordable units are over income by more than 50% for two consecutive months. And the reason they recommended this was to ensure that our deed-restricted affordable units are continued to be rented to qualifying households and creating opportunities for them instead of creating a pretextual eviction if someone's income has just marginally increased.
Mm-hmm.
The reason we are not recommending this is all of our affordable housing agreements have something in them that talks about when someone's income goes up, what happens. So we don't see that there's a need to put this in our eviction ordinance because the regulatory agreement already dictates what has to happen. Some properties allow people's income to go up to 84%. Some people go up 84%. Some properties allow it to go up to 140%.
Mm-hmm.
It's in the regulatory agreement. They vary. Some of them is determined by other funding sources, but it is something that lives there, so we don't feel like it's necessary to put it here.
Mm-hmm. And the category of gig workers, that goes up, down, up, down.
But on most of the properties, trying to think if I can think of one that doesn't, allow people's incomes to go up.
Okay.
Most of the
not consecutively up for 2 years. More than 50% for 2 years.
That was their recommendation. That's not.
Okay.
Every property has something slightly different. Mm-hmm. I think the only properties that don't, you still aren't evicted. If your income goes up, you're not evicted.
Mm-hmm.
You just convert to market.
Mm-hmm.
But there is no eviction that is issued because your income goes up. Mm-hmm. You just now have to pay market rent.
Mm-hmm.
So you're saying it's better to have these individually negotiated terms rather than one blanket, like one.
It's already in the agreement.
It's already in the agreement. So this
it's
would
already
be
in the agreement.
Overriding existing agreement.
There's no, right. This would then be a policy, but what's living in the agreement still lives. So then nobody would have to comply with this because they all have recorded. This would only then apply to new properties.
But then I have a question.
So
I'm sorry. If those units convert to market rate, and are you losing that unit?
No, they then have to give us the next available market rate unit. They have to rent it to somebody at an affordable level.
Okay.
Yeah.
So is there any harm in putting this in place? Like, what would be the if it's
because not all of our property. This policy doesn't exist for any of our properties.
Mm-hmm.
The funding
creating a new cause for eviction. You're allowing landlords to go in and evict people because they raise their income above threshold. Now we have policies to handle that situation, but now we're issuing a citywide policy that allows these landlords to evict. Well, and we just didn't see the
right. It's already there for continuity. I think it makes sense.
So we don't tell them they can't be evicted anyway. They just convert to market. And if you don't want to pay market rent, then you move. No eviction necessary.
Yeah. That makes sense.
Okay. Number three, we want to revise our occupancy violation requirement to, one, prohibit at-fault evictions of tenants who exceed occupancy requirements for households with children under 18, which means if you're living, let's say, in a studio let me use a one bedroom. If you're living in a one bedroom, it's you and your spouse and you have one child, because a one bedroom occupancy limit is three, and you get pregnant. This would prohibit them from being able to evict you because you have brought another child into your unit. Because you have two children under 18, those children won't count towards occupancy. The second thing we want to do is clarify that landlords have the right to approve replacement tenants based on reasonable criteria that's provided by the city. So if you're living in a unit with a roommate, your roommate is getting married and so wants to move out, and you're like, I found somebody new. The landlord has to approve it. The landlord tells you no. And you're like, well, I can't afford the rent, so then you get evicted. Well, we don't want it to be arbitrary, which is what it is right now. Mm-hmm. We want to set defined reasons or defined criteria that have to be met for a landlord to deny your replacement unit. West Hollywood, Larkspur, and Half Moon Bay have policies similar to this. And again, this is to help prevent displacement and potential conflicts that arise through replacements. It is go through the store and then second door. Oh, no, come this way. You have to come this way.
Through the door.
And then
it's
the door that's open.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll leave that door open.
Valerie, who's the reasonable criteria?
This came from our consultant, PlaceWorks.
Okay, so they would draft a reasonable criteria.
They have drafted something.
Oh, they already drafted it. Okay.
They have drafted something. Yeah. So that's our third requirement. So we are recommending this one be submitted to City Council. Mm-hmm. Number four, require evidence of material damage. This policy is to require landlords to have evidence of demonstrable injury to the landlord or to other residents if you're evicting somebody for breach of lease, something mm-hmm. like that. They're also recommending that they require written acceptances of lease terms. So when you move into an apartment, you sign your lease. I had a great example of this. In my property, they changed the policy regarding parking. They sent us an email telling us what the change is. Now, if I don't read my emails, I never see it, and then all of a sudden I might start getting fined. This would require, if you change a term of the lease, the tenant has to actually sign off.
Yeah.
You have to have something that the tenant has acknowledged that they've seen it and received it, not just, oh, I sent them a notice that the policy changed.
Yeah.
Oakland, West Hollywood, Berkeley does this, again, to prevent pretextual termination notices for minor infractions mm-hmm. that could be resolved without eviction and to encourage tenant awarenesses of their terms of the lease.
And can this even expand to... Say I got an email and said I need to access your unit. I never saw it. I never acknowledged it. And then you get a call. Somebody says, oh, there's somebody in your apartment, and I know you're in Hawaii.
Right.
And I'm like, what? You know what I mean? And so it be for things like that too. Like everything related to repairing something, or like, you know what I mean?
I do see what you're talking about. The problem is that this would only live in our eviction ordinance.
Okay.
We would have to figure out if there's a way of putting something like that. I don't know, a harassment. I don't know where that that's a tenant landlord issue. I don't know.
Yeah,
where that
I need acknowledgement of communication. An acknowledgement of communication. That's it. Because that's, I can't even tell you how many times that happened.
You can mm-hmm. look into that, make a note, but yeah, we would have to figure out where to place that.
Yeah.
So if the change in these terms is not in the interest of the tenant, and the tenant's just like, they don't want to sign it, then like, what happens?
I mean, usually there's a thing where you can say presented to tenant refused to sign, and usually there's options like
that.
If the tenant does say I refuse to sign. It could become an issue where now you're in breach because your lease may say you are required to sign off when I send you new policies. Mm-hmm. You know,
or even just having the option, I choose to decline or whatever. It's not a yes. It's
I acknowledge receipt, but I just
right. It's not asking you to agree. Just acknowledge that you have, yeah, something of that nature.
And like a proof of service, like when you're serving people legal documents.
But if you don't acknowledge, then they can't enforce that term of your lease. So it is.
Oh, then it becomes incumbent upon them to get you.
Yeah.
To find you.
Yeah.
To find you. And he's like, I'm at your door at 8 a.m. and at 5 p.m. Where are you? I don't know. You know.
Right.
But that you see, and that's a pretty easy one, though. They just, it's putting something on your door when you go in and when you come out, unless it falls on the floor or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's an easy way to get a hold of you.
Yeah. And again, 90-something percent of our termination notices are for rent, not for a lot of these other issues. But I think these solve, if those situations arise, they're addressing these issues, we don't get a lot of material damage eviction notices. Number five, define imminent owner move-in. Currently, our policy says that an owner must move in imminently. And we're always saying, what does imminently mean? So we are looking to define it as that family member would need to move in within 90 days of the end of the terminated tenancy.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing we want to do is require the owner or the owner to provide evidence to the city that they have completed the move in within the required time. Because if somebody gives you a no fault eviction for owner move in and there is a right to return requirement for the tenant. If for whatever reason things change, how will the tenant know if anybody ever moved into the unit? It happened to me. I was renting a house and they decided they wanted to sell, and so I moved. Then I started thinking, how do I know they actually sold it?
Mm-hmm.
I started like driving by the house. I was like, I don't want to be looked like a stalker. But I was like, how would I know? And then, yes, I saw somebody else there. I said, okay, somebody else. I saw the for sale sign. I looked on Zillow. It sold. But, you know, how would somebody know without, and, you know, I'm in this industry, so I know to look. If you're a lay person, you may not know or have the time to do all that research. So we want to require that they provide documentation, that owner has to provide documentation back to the city. Concord, Berkeley, and Oakland all do this. Concord and Berkeley actually monitor. They don't actually require evidence to come back. They actually do monitoring in order to determine if the owner has done that.
Mm-hmm.
We're just saying, no, we want to put the onus on them, not require us to monitor, but put the onus on them to provide documentation back to us.
All right.
Number six, we want to define required 50% stake of ownership if somebody wants to move in, which means that the owner has to own the property at least 50% in order to use an owner move-in. You can't own it between six people and each one of you has 20%. You can't do an owner move-in. You have to have at least 50%. This actually already existed in our administrative regulations, but it is not in the ordinance.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to move it to the ordinance. Again, with Hollywood, Berkeley, Los Angeles, Concord, they all have that same 50% requirement. I think we found one city, San Francisco,
who was on the lower end.
Someone was at 25%.
Well, Concord, I think, was at 25.
Oh, and Concord was at 25, sorry. Yeah.
Was below that 25.
Yeah, but we want to stick with the 50. Okay, number seven. We want to include spouse or domestic partner as eligible for an owner move-in. For whatever reason, it didn't identify them. It said the owner, their children, their parents. It didn't say their spouse or their domestic partner.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to add spouse and domestic partner as permitted family members for an owner move-in.
What about siblings of the owner?
Do you recall, what is our actual?
Family members?
Yeah, there is a definition for family members. I know it's children. Parents, and it might have somebody else in there. I don't recall.
The current one?
Yeah, in our current policy. And the domestic partner and spouse actually is in the state law. All the other cities do it, and we just want to make sure that we're inclusive, you know, and not excluding anybody.
One of my landlord's parents or children. So what we currently have is landlord, landlord parent, or landlord child.
So not siblings.
No.
Okay.
I don't know if there's any cities that we looked at that have siblings.
I think there are some cities that do grandparents or grandchildren.
That makes sense.
I've seen that. I don't know that it's necessary here, but I believe in Los Angeles or Los Angeles County, They actually also include a property manager can be used for owner movement.
Property manager?
They do that, which probably makes more sense when you have a lot of, like, quadruplexes and eight-unit buildings that maybe you do have somebody who comes and manages your building, and you want them to, you want to now bring somebody in to manage your building, so you move them into a unit. They actually include that. Outside of down in Southern California, I didn't see anybody in the Bay Area that did that, and I don't think it would be necessary here in New York building.
Yeah. Can you give, like, someone 50, like the other 50% of your ownership and have them move in?
You would have to sell them.
Yeah.
Sell it to them.
Yeah. Okay.
Policy number eight, though, kind of gets to that a little bit, too, is we want to limit the number of no-fault evictions due to owner move-in that can occur within a parcel within a five-year period, regardless of ownership.
We've seen that happen.
We have not, but the example that was provided to us was you own a property. And you say, well, I'm going to have my mother move into one unit. And actually, now I want to have my sister move or my child move into the other unit. And I want to have, not just to get everybody out of the building now. This is to prevent that from happening. And it also would then say, even if you sold, because this is where the example came in, somebody sold the building then to their cousin. So they could move other people in as an owner move in? No. Which is why it's limiting it to one owner move in allowed per parcel.
What was the purpose of that? I'm just curious. Why wasn't it do that?
They wanted to get everybody out of the property and not have tenants.
Yeah. To sell later.
Maybe they want to do something different, but they're trying to figure out a way of getting out without having to do
anything.
Well, they would have to still pay them because they'd have to do pre-location.
Property
values can differ based off whether you have a tenant or not. So say you have a house, say you have a duplex or a triplex, and then you have, you know, three people, three different tenant households, and then say you want to sell that triplex, well, that price can be like $500,000 difference. So you say, I'm moving my mom, my grandma, and my daughter into each unit, and then you can.
So now the new owner is like, oh, I don't have to deal with all those rent issues. And yeah, that's true.
Let's say also all the tenants, maybe it's rent control or whatever.
So Berkeley and San Francisco, they currently do a policy like that. So we're recommending that one be submitted to City Council. Number nine. We want to define cosmetic improvements as ineligible basis for eviction. So we want to add language that defines cosmetic improvements and specifies that non-qualifying repairs for substantial renovation include only those that can be performed safely without having the unit vacated. So what we don't want to do is people to say, well, I'm renovating the unit, and that's why I'm evicting these tenants. Well, they could have lived there during those renovations, so we don't want that to happen. So Larkspur, Hillsburg, Half Moon Bay, they all have defining information as to what qualifies as cosmetic, what qualifies as substantial rehab, and so we're hoping that that'll help just create additional clarity as to what is a cosmetic versus what is not. Because, again, undefined term, it can mean something different to different people.
And those are already written somewhere?
I think they have given us draft language on it.
And are they going to include so there's a huge distinction between cosmetic and, say, substantial construction or bringing a building up to code, blah, blah, blah. And there's, depending on the languaging that you use, are the new recommendations very, very clear about what is and what is not?
So not in these set of recommendations. However, my thought, what we've talked about, is that we will get to more clarity under the temporary relocation assistance, because that's really, through that policy, I think we're going to address what somebody needs to be temporarily relocated for, and what kind of renovations are. So it's not in this recommendation, But I completely agree with you. We need to get there, but it'll be in that phase two of the temporary relocation stage.
I think what would be really helpful is the interchangeable words of improvement, upgrade,
mm-hmm.
Tenant improvement, developer requirement, whether it's state or
yes.
city. It has to be clearly defined, and it could be like a list that's like 200 things long, but I'm all for it.
I don't know that we'll get to something like that. But we're going to try to put more specificity.
Or don't interchange,
yes.
like have a key. Improvements means this.
Mm-hmm.
Substantial renovation is this. Substantial construction is this. Demolition is this. I'm not repairing something. I'm ripping it out
mm-hmm.
and I'm putting it something new.
Right.
Not I decided to upgrade something,
mm-hmm.
but it's a completely tear down your whole building.
Yes.
A number of these policy recommendations, Tyler was asking about one earlier, like the criteria, and it doesn't seem to be like. The specifics are not in here.
Correct.
Is that what you're going to be submitting to council? Is just that, you know, we adopt a policy, but then later kind of fill out the specifics of the criteria.
Correct. What we'll be submitting at the study session is probably going to be really close to this.
Okay.
High level. These are the types of things we're looking to modify the agreement with.
Okay.
Are you in somewhat agreement about that? Because what we don't want to do is spend all the time
mm-hmm.
fully defining and baking everything. If people are like, I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm. I see, yeah.
Which is why we're going to do the study session.
Okay.
Then we will come back with how it's all written out in the ordinance for everybody.
Okay.
And that's what you guys will actually be adopting
and
recommending.
That's when it comes back to us. Okay,
yeah.
That makes sense. That's why we're on there.
We're going to do a high-level policy or... Are you guys good with the policy? And then we'll come back with this is how we're looking to build the policy out.
One other quick.
Sure.
This defined cosmetic improvements as ineligible basis for eviction.
Mm-hmm.
This number 9 needs to be in tandem with that other.
Yes.
Part.
Which is
like,
why we're going to bring them together.
Two separate things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why we're going. That's originally they were going to run separately, but we realized.
Yeah.
We need to bring them together for a lot of reasons, but it's not what you're talking about.
Subjectivity.
It is subjectivity, and there's crossover, and there's things that will change our tenant ordinance once we put in that temporary relocation policy, so we need to move them together,
mm-hmm.
which is why we had to push things out till September, because we need to finish up those recommendations. Mm-hmm. So we can bring them. So they will move together. They're just coming to you guys separately.
Right. Because a lot of it has to do with landlord discretionary
right.
discretion, and that's borderline exploitation.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Number 10 is we want to require earlier payment of tenant relocation assistance. Right now, our policy says that the relocation assistance has to be made on the last day of tenancy. The problem with that is if you're moving, you need money before the last day you're there. So our recommendation is to require at least 50% of that relocation assistance to be paid within 15 days of delivering the notice to terminate tenancy. So when I give you that notice, I have to give you 50% in 15 days, and then you get the remaining 50% on the last day of tenancy.
Yeah.
So Oakland does that. They do 50% actually at the issuance of the notice and then 50% at move out. Berkeley does 100% within 10 days. Our recommendation is doing the 50 and 50.
Mm-hmm.
And it also provides the defense of no-fault eviction. If you have not received your money by the last day, guess what? You don't have to move.
Mm-hmm.
And remind me again, I know we've covered this, but the relocation assistance is for a limited period of time. I think we said 28 days was not right up
there. Well, that's on temporary relocation.
That's temporary relocation.
That's not what this is. This
okay.
is permanent relocation.
Permanent relocation assistance.
Yeah. This is permanent relocation assistance.
Okay.
Yeah, this is different.
Which is about what you just said about, like, if you don't get your last 50% on the last day, then you don't have to move. But then that person probably has already gone through all the motions of needing to move those or anything that enforces the landlord then give them the other 50% to move because they've already done all the work.
Oh, no. No, all this would do would provide a defense as the reason you didn't leave the unit and they're not calling you down a squatter is because they didn't comply with this ordinance. So that's your defense as to why you didn't leave because you didn't get your last 50%. You did get the first 50, you just didn't get the last 50.
Well, wouldn't that create a problem where that person then is kind of in limbo? Because what if they've already committed, so you know, signed the lease to somewhere else because they've already been told that they have an eviction? Wouldn't in that case then Berkeley's 100% within 10 days make more sense? So it's like more clear.
I think so.
I definitely think
that's what I was thinking.
And also, it's like when you're moving out, like, what good is it to have the money the day before you move out?
Yeah.
Like the whole, you need all of it. You need a deposit, a down payment. You need to change your utilities. You need moving supplies. Mm-hmm. Like, you need that money at least 10 days before you move.
So your guys' recommendation would be to do something more similar to Berkeley.
Yeah.
And I would say more like 15 days. I mean, if they're gonna plan far enough in advance to have you move out for some reason, that landlord's gotta be more prepared to like pay you. So at least 15 days and 100%, I think.
Yeah, at least 15 days. But I mean, everything works with 30 days. It's 30, 60, 90 days. Like your leases, your this, your that.
You have to give them
moving like into an old new place, do all that stuff. You don't. It should be. It's so, great to have at least 15, but the whole system works on 30, 60, 90.
Yeah.
Wait. But no, it's within 10 days of delivering the notice, not within 10 days of
the eviction.
Right.
So what Berkeley does is the day I give you the notice, in 10 days I have to give you money.
When do you have to give the notice?
You mean how long the notice are you getting?
Like 3 weeks.
We talked about that. I don't know if we found the answer, but
is it a state law?
It depends on, because of the LFAX eviction, right? So the LFAX is when you're taking your whole building offline. And so that there's like specific requirements regarding noticing. But usually like there's, when they're doing this like planned eviction, it's usually like a matter of months you're getting. It could depend, like it could be hopefully.
We need that question. We actually had that internal question when we were going through. I was just like, how long of a notice do you get anyway? So I think we need to pull that information so that we can have that, because I don't know how long that is. It's a question that we can ask and get more detail. And we'll put that notice down here for right now, that additional detail is needed on how long is that termination notice for, based off of the various no-fault termination notices.
Yeah.
I mean, because, like, if you're moving out, that landlord expects 30 days notice, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So why shouldn't they get 30 days? I mean,
oh, it's at least 30 days. It might be more than 30.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I don't know. I don't know why. I feel like a couple of years ago, maybe they extended it to 60. But I don't recall.
I think that you need as much time as you can get to, if they, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what I think.
People usually will use not one check for rent, one and a half check.
Mm-hmm.
So that's 30 days.
Number 11 is we want to, there was a request to add a policy that there would be an additional relocation payment that would be issued for low-income and senior tenants. The reason that they're recommending doing this is that low-income and senior tenants often face insecurity when it comes to new housing, especially after a no-fault eviction. And so this would provide them with that additional cushion of getting 1 month additional rent if you meet one of those qualifications. The recommendation would be that the city would provide a self-reporting form in order to determine that qualification. Gilbert, West Hollywood, Berkeley, Oakland, Concord, they actually all have a policy like that. Now, staff is still considering this policy. We do not have a recommendation yet as to what we're going to recommend to City Council, and that's for a couple of reasons. One, most of no-fault evictions are going to occur with a small landlord.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to ask.
And what we don't want What the concern that's raised is if we put this criteria out there that they have to now pay those type of tenants more, is that going to potentially impact them wanting to rent to low income and seniors? And a lot of cities do this. And so we don't know what the data says yet, but it's giving us some pause that we're just not quite sure yet whether or not this is a recommendation we want to move forward. We like the idea, but we don't want it to negatively impact people then all of a sudden, you know, drastically kind of discriminating, you know, and trying to skirt the law for discrimination purposes because they're like, I don't want to have to pay them that extra money.
That would be illegal, though, right?
Mm-hmm.
For them to...
It would be illegal.
But that it happens is what you're saying.
I hate to say it, but like, you know, the other side of the policy question is maybe that those funds should not come from a landlord. They should come from some kind of safety net funds that the city or county provides. So that, again, that's two times I'm seeing the need for safety net funds as opposed to.
And then why is disability not in there?
I don't know why they didn't recommend disability. They just didn't. I mean, that could be a recommendation that could come out. We've seen, I've seen the disability, I've seen people who terminal illness be, you know, reasons, but it was not included in the recommendation. And we did not ask them why they didn't include that one. We were focused on the other issues of, ooh,
because a lot of people do also get assistance because they can't work. So,
you know how long that they'll put those policies have been in place with birth and Oakland framing jobs?
For a while.
And it's been working.
I don't know. And we had we did not do interviews with Berkeley and Oakland. And even with the cities we did do interviews with, that question didn't come up. So there's some things that now that we see the recommendations are like, oh, we wish we would have asked a different question, but we didn't think about it at that time. So I think there might be some future follow-up we might do if we can get people on the phone, but yeah, we didn't ask.
Also, like, self-reporting, like who self-reports? Like
the tenant would have to fill out some type of paperwork that the city would create that for them to determine whether or not they'd have to provide certain information so that we could determine, yes, you meet the qualifications.
So we wouldn't check to actually see if they were low income? We would just take their word for it?
The recommendation is to do a self-reporting form. It always could be a form where they have to submit supporting documentation. That part hasn't been fleshed out yet.
Was it senior age?
That hadn't been recommended yet. I don't think it was
high-level policy.
I don't know if it's 55 or 62. I don't recall what they...
The age and what we would be considering lower income will both need to be defined.
Yeah, I think lower income is 80%, but I don't remember what the age was. If it was 55 or 62, it's one of those two.
Was the general high? What's the average?
Yeah. For what?
Is there more policies with 55 or 62?
Usually the definition of senior, certain policies define it as 55 and some policies define it as 62. So that's why I just don't recall. I don't recall what it was. But it's one of those two ages.
I will be interested in this policy if we have more definitions.
Yeah.
But actually gains any traction.
And if it was on the lower percentage of the low income. Mm-hmm.
You need to have some data.
I don't know if data exists on that, but yeah. Okay, number 12 is our tenants' rights to organize. So these had come to you guys a long, long time ago, and so they're just they're putting in there the same components of the tenants' right to organize. It's adding a right for tenants to confer with other tenants, the right to convene meetings, to distribute post information, work with outside organizations or advocates, and that the landlord and tenant organizations must confer with each other in good faith.
Mm-hmm.
Half Moon Bay, West Hollywood, Berkeley, Concord, they all do this. These are part of the recommended best practices related to tenants' rights to organize.
I mean, like, can you stop them from doing any of those things anyway? I mean,
potentially, a landlord could be like, you're not allowed. You can't have this meeting in the clubhouse.
Councilmember Pride Forest, this was like a big thing for him. He talks about this extensively. This was because I guess he's been engaging in a lot of this.
And they were like, no, you can't do that. You know, so yeah, this would prevent them from being able to say no. Or I think we saw in other cities, there were issues where maybe they did allow you to meet, but they didn't allow you to bring in other organizations to come in and to help you. And so this is to say, no, you can't prevent that, me from bringing somebody else in to help us organize this tenant group.
So right now, the tenant's rights to organize, and if they needed to reach out, the person that they would reach out to right now is Echo.
You can organize independently.
But I mean, if they wanted to reach out to somebody
about
outside of outside of themselves,
they could reach out to any organization that does tenant rights. So there's a lot. There's Echo. There's Central Legal. There's State Community Law. Those all deal in like tenant landlord.
Yeah. Is there anybody here? In this office, this building.
They're just looking at the people here. Whether or not they actually help coordinate those, I don't know that they actually provide that service about creating tenant organizations. I don't know. I don't know if there are.
No, not about creating tenant organizations. Getting advice for tenant rights.
Yes, all of that would be Echo.
So there's no one here that if I called and said, I want to know my tenant's rights, that could tell me.
No, because that would be me or Emily, and we would prefer you to Echo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, three more.
All right, three more. They want us to require modified text in our notice of tenant rights. They want us to add language to the Notice of Tenant Rights that includes these new policies related to tenant rights to organize, to be protected from harassing behavior, and new requirements regarding bringing civil actions in court.
Mm-hmm.
They're also recommending we include contact information for available support services in that tenant's rights notice.
Mm-hmm.
Berkeley does this, Oakland does that, San Francisco does that. Again, it's to provide tenants with more information. And so they know who to contact if they have questions, which gets to your question.
Yeah, so you can see, like, there's variations, right? So Berkeley has explicit tenants' rights organized, and they'll tell you that when they give you the notice of rights, that to go to the record question, so Oakland has their rent adjustment program office, and then San Francisco, because they have the legal right to counsel, they post, like, information about where they get legal assistance if you're dealing with eviction, as well as their rent burden, and the acronym is the Mayor's Office of Housing and Development. So they also include that information on their notices in case you need help finding housing.
So if you move into a place and your lease doesn't have the tenant's rights and we can only get tenant's rights from Echo, then what's the point of the city ordinance, landlord?
So we're going to get to that. This recommendation is about adding that additional language and the support services. I don't know if the next one gets to yours, but there is something that will get to yours.
So it would be like creating a document that really like expands upon what services are available for residents. And like because these cities, like they have a document that you can download, that landlords can download and give the tenants that they need the all information.
But if we didn't get that and it's now being implemented, what happens to all the people that are before this jump?
So I just jumped real quick just to get to you. So it's one of the programmatic recommendations, not a policy recommendation, is that the city actually provide a sample tenants' right notice that we're providing. Right now our language says this is the type of information that must be included. Instead of giving them that language, we actually have the actual document with all the information. It would be translated into English and Spanish on the city's website, and the resources would be updated annually.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that it typically works is that when we would implement this change, every time you renew your lease, somebody moves in, then you would have to submit that notice to the tenant.
Mm-hmm.
That's how they would get the notice if you're an existing tenant.
So the programmatic.
It's the property. It's a programmatic change.
Programmatic is enforceable, or that piece of paper that you're talking about, that bit is enforceable, or is the landlord tenant city ordinance enforceable?
They work hand in hand. So us providing that physical document is a programmatic thing. It's something we're doing administratively. it's already in the city's ordinance to have tenant rights that have to be provided to the tenants at certain times. What we're doing is changing what that document is and to be something that the city would create versus you must include this language in your noticing. That's what so it's a programmatic change. The city has to create the document. What's changing in the policy is that we're going to expand the type of information that's in that notice and the fact that instead of saying you this is mandatory language, you are now required to use the city form.
Yeah.
That's the policy side. The programmatic side is the creation of the form. It still is all enforceable. It still is a requirement because in our ordinance right now, it's a requirement that they provide you notice when they evict. The change will also be that they have to give you that notice not just upon eviction. They have to give it to you upon lease renewal so that you're getting it more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
You should be getting it almost like every year.
What if that never happens?
If they never do it going forward?
No, for the best.
Well, this is about going forward.
Yeah.
Well, how is it enforced? So this is like, so if it didn't happen or if it doesn't happen, who would a tenant go to for these types of policies? Like,
we'd have to look and see, is there an enforcement if it doesn't happen? Mm-hmm. I don't recall off the top of my head. Some of these things are identified as enforceable actions. Some mm-hmm. of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
I guess potentially you could always sue the landlord,
mm-hmm.
but unless... But really, I think what happens is if they evict you and it didn't happen,
mm-hmm.
that would be a reasonable cause to prevent your eviction.
Okay.
I never got this notice.
Okay.
Versus I'm still living here, but I don't know if there's anything for you to do.
But if there's no one to talk to here about just that event, then the only...
It's Echo. That's who the city pays to provide that service.
Why don't you talk to Echo
about I mean... Staffing is small,
mm-hmm.
so we have to expand our capacity by using other entities. We contract with Echo, which is why I keep saying if somebody has that issue, we refer them to Echo. Echo answers that those questions on our behalf. We don't have staff available to do it.
Well, I'm also from a legal standpoint, too, if you're like, you know, that like that's a reasonable defense, like an unlawful detainer or something like that, if Echo was helping to fill out the form. One of the defenses I didn't get the form, like it's easily something that they would be able to check off on the like in the back and forth. I'm sure Echo
right.
could like they would raise all those defenses
absolutely.
And have evidence of not being able to show it.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. 14. Minimum damages. This says that a landlord attempting to wrongfully recover possession of a unit may be liable for damages of not less than 3 times the actual damage. Plus whatever other relief the court deems appropriate. The prevailing tenant can also be entitled to reasonable attorney fees and court costs. Our current policy does not define the amount of damages. The reason that this has been recommended to be done is because what we see is that landlords bring their attorneys to court and tenants don't have anybody. And because we don't have the ability of providing legal support like San Francisco does, this is the alternative solution to incentivize a tenant to say to a lawyer, if you think that my case is valid, you can get recouped through the lawsuit because this says that I can get reasonable fees.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we're trying to build it in that way so that potentially attorneys will be more willing to help help tenants. So all these other cities, they actually already do that exact same kind of thing. 15, we are recommending that the landlord provide rental assistance program documentation within a specific period of time. So on this one, we're requiring the landlord to provide the tenant with documentation necessary to support a rental assistance program application within 10 days of request. During COVID, this was one of the huge issues that came up, that tenants were applying for rental assistance, but the landlord would not submit the required documentation, so the tenant never got the money.
Mm-hmm.
And then the landlord is in the process of evicting. So this would prohibit a landlord from dragging their feet, not providing the required documents if a tenant has a rental assistance program application that they're trying to get, but the landlord has to provide documentation within 10 days. Mm-hmm. Oakland currently does this, and they have it identified as a defense against eviction if the landlord did not do it.
Yeah, I like that one.
When COVID happened, is a landlord able to approach the tenant?
Sure. About, hey, there's a program out here. Apply for it? Yes. We have landlords do that.
And then organize it that all and okay.
Yeah, they were able to do that. So, yeah, we're in support of that one by doing that like that, too. Number 16, it's a defense for vulnerable populations. So this policy recommendation is to provide families with school-aged children in a physical school with a defense against a no-fault eviction during the Emory Unified School District school year. This is to address displacement so that you cannot displace a family with a school-aged child for a no-fault eviction during the school year. Mm-hmm. You have to wait until the school year is over. The second component of this policy recommendation is that you would provide victims of domestic violence, elder abuse, human trafficking. There's a long list of types of issues related to that that have acted, which means that they have filed a police report. They've been going through some process with a temporary defense against an eviction. Mm-hmm. So Oakland and Concord, they have policies related to the children. Half Moon Bay does the policies related to domestic violence cases and children. Mm-hmm. And, again, it's to prevent households that are going through those kind of issues from being displaced as well.
But just from no-fault evictions. This is not from at-fault evictions, right? Like this
there's
family
some nuance.
Can't like just not pay rent for a year, for the school year, right? Like,
No. Well, you're talking about the school-age children one?
Yeah, probably. I mean,
the school-age children one would say no, it's for no, yeah, that one is only for a no-fault.
Only for no-fault.
Right. So you can't do an owner move-in,
yes,
you can't substantially renovate, you can't do any of those things,
right.
Can't get off the market during the school year.
The second one, safety net signs, like that's where that should come from. That should not be something that should penalize a landlord. You have a landlord that has a two units, and one of them is having domestic violence. As much as I'm a caseworker and I'm on the side of people that are having those problems,
mm-hmm.
still you can't penalize the landlord from the, you know, two units that he's renting out, like, you know, for based on their domestic violence situation. Like there's gotta be safety net fines that person can apply for instead of
to relocate.
Instead of policies that have to do with landlords.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like that fund that you named the last time about something, yeah, and nobody's using it, there's the safety net funds. Like, I'm also into a lot of housing policy, and, like, I'm constantly advocating for more safety net funds. That's what's going to cure homelessness. Like, it's not going to be some policies for landlords. It's going to be, you know, policies creating safety net funds and prevention and all that stuff.
I think we should just note that I think the person who's like the perpetrator has to be out of the unit, but to use as defense. You're saying that like if somebody's being, the person who is the perpetrator of the abuse has to be no longer in the unit. And so it wouldn't be a relocation situation that helps clarify like what.
I mean, but then. So I know I've gotten a call.
But then they get kicked out of the unit this month, and then they let back in, and they kicked out of the unit.
No. So that actually is written in Half Moon Bay, and they're recommending it that way. I've gotten a call from a tenant who's complaining about noise and the police being called all the time mm-hmm. to a unit, right? And they're like, they're disrupting my living in my unit. Well, let's say that is a case of domestic violence. If that is a case of domestic violence and the person who is being perpetrated on is going through the legal process and there's, let's say, a restraining order, they'd have to document there's a restraining order, then this would prevent
the landlord from saying, I'm evicting you because I'm tired of the police coming to my property and you causing a new nuisance. This would prevent the landlord from doing that. On the flip side, the way Half Moon Bay wrote their ordinance is if that person who's being perpetrated on allows the perpetrator to come back to the property, it now removes that protection.
That gets tricky. Does someone even define if they are allowed? Like in a lot of domestic violence situations, a lot of the times the person that is being, you know, not just allowing the person to come in. So how do you even?
That's a great point.
Find that.
Which is why I didn't put it on here.
Yeah.
But that part of the recommendation, our legal team has concerns about as to enforcement and how do you determine that.
Yeah.
So they've brought up those exact same issues, and they're like, we're going to have to look into this more.
I just feel like these two things are very different from each other and are really not one policy recommendation. My understanding, like, the issues around...
I think they're just defining the most vulnerable population.
I feel like the discussion is different on these two. The second one is a lot trickier, especially because at least the way it's worded here, I mean, I can understand you want to prevent eviction of someone suffering under domestic violence for the reason of the domestic violence creating noise, et cetera, but like, there are many other possible things that could be happening. Like, that doesn't mean they can't pay rent. They don't have to pay rent. Like, I mean,
not call on the landlord to fix this problem.
It's too complicated.
No, that one I don't believe was about a no fault.
Oh, what if this was a regular?
That one I believe was a regular. That's what I was going to ask you. Do you recall? I don't think in the language that I have it distinguished it from the two, so we may have to look at some of the other documents they've given us to see.
So they each have their own. So
the one at the top was specifically for no fault.
No fault.
Yeah, they did not write no fault on that second one.
Also, I'm curious if that can make, like, you know, undetected discriminatory issues to renting with people with children or families, just like how we were talking about with the other policy, how that could be.
Because it's only applicable on no fault.
Yeah.
Could it create an issue?
Yeah, I mean, I like the policy, but I just thought that happened.
I don't see that the domestic violence defense actually ties back to no fault at fault. It just provides, I think the understanding would be that usually you're not going to have a non-payment situation and then somebody's like, oh, I'm a victim of DD. I think the assumption was that it was because we need to make sure
you have more clarity about
it. I think clarity of the reason for the eviction shouldn't be tied to the domestic violence. Like, what makes this person vulnerable?
It makes it very clear that the cause of the eviction is the defense.
Okay, yeah.
In human trafficking, they need to move if that's the case. I mean, no offense, but.
The other thing I was going to say, Valerie, about the domestic violence, has legal done a review on, like, because for at least for DD, I'm thinking about, like, in Oakland, for example, the courts, despite them sometimes being slow, move through DD cases very quickly. Right. So it's like they'll issue an emergency DD for a short period of time. I'm curious what legal's point of view is for a restraining order that's, like, not super long. They may give them a temporary restraining order, and then they may issue a restraining order for like 1 year, right? Mm-hmm. So then the landlord's in the clear for 1 year, and then maybe the victim doesn't renew the restraining order. So now they're back to maybe this issue caused by the money or not being able to pay rent because the restraining orders are only valid for an extended period of time. Then the landlord may find themselves back in this situation
I think language is really important and like making sure that if the reason for eviction is like that there's chaos going on around the beach, so this is to protect from that,
right?
Yeah, that makes sense to me,
but it's not clear on the language,
but I think it needs to be very clear.
But I hear your point also about how are the courts responding to these types of cases, and then how does that, which is why I think the attorney was like, that one they needed to spend some time on.
Yeah,
the point about temporary restraining orders is really important because the courts tend to I mean, without having seen any evidence, they'll give it a version saying it could just be for 2 weeks or a month, just until they can see the evidence, right? Just to make sure that to err on the side of protecting the victim.
And if the victim doesn't show up for the
permanent, it all goes away. Most of them just fall away. So the temporary may not be a good enough threshold.
Yeah. No, this is good.
Yeah.
Things that I had not thought about when it, I just knew the legal didn't like this, that part of it, but thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, real quick, because I know we're after 8 o'clock. So our first programmatic recommendation was to expand education and mediation. This would be increasing our educational outreach regarding our ordinance and available resources for tenants. Right now, our contract is that they provide a workshop once a year, so this would be us increasing that. We don't have a specific number, but we want there to be more educational outreach opportunities. And then also their recommendation was to establish a mediation hearing process. West Hollywood, Half Moon Bay, Berkeley all do this. We are recommending expanding our education opportunities, but we're not recommending the mediation services be submitted to City Council as a recommendation, only because this was looked at years ago. And there's a financial cost related to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the city decided that they didn't have the financial resources to want to establish that system and build that up. So that's why it's not being recommended. But
I mean, mediation would be super helpful for a lot to avoid a lot of these other problems, I feel like, where landlords are having to pay, where tenants are having to be displaced if they could come to a middle ground with the support of the city.
It was my understanding that there has in the past, and I thought it was still in place, that there is mediation services.
ECHO can provide that, but there's not like a mediation board or a requirement. Some other cities provide mediation services to where the landlord and the tenant come down and have to talk, and then they have to mediate.
Mm-hmm.
It's just provided to where they will talk to the landlord on your behalf, but not that there actually is like a hearing.
And ECHO can't enforce anything.
Right.
So the mediation is like,
we can
tell them stuff. So.
And I don't know that the other ones that do the mediation hearing, I don't think it's enforceable with them either.
Mm.
Usually they just get people to come to an agreement, but I still don't know that it's enforceable. I talked about number 2, so it's providing the notice. It's a specific notice that we'll provide. It'll be translated into English and Spanish. It will include all the requirements, and it'll be updated more frequently so that because we'll be providing the form, we will update it with all the new resources, make sure the numbers are correct.
Wait, just English and Spanish?
Just English and Spanish, correct.
Is that all that we have living in Emeryville?
It's not all that we have living. The reason we're just recommending English and Spanish is there is a formulaic calculation that has to be done when we have federal funds. And under that, we, based off of the percentage of population we have living in Emeryville that has limited English speaking at home, we don't exceed the percentage to require any other language for all the other language bands.
Is that much of an expense?
Yeah, I was about to say, like,
what? I don't know what the expense would be.
Especially if it's digital, I feel like it's...
Is there another language that you guys would recommend?
Whatever language they speak here.
I mean,
but there could be 20 languages.
Open has a lot of different languages.
It doesn't seem like translating costs very much money. You can do it on Google. Like, you don't have to...
We can't do it on Google. Because it's not always accurate, because there's legal information in there, we'd actually have to have contract with a company that does legal translation services.
Maybe I would think that at least one other language might be good to be included. I don't know which one it would be, but not if it's in our data, like where if there's not enough people in the category.
I think what's come up is that we do have other people who speak it, but who are not limited English speaking here. Like they speak English and something else, but they don't just speak something else and not English, which is why usually what you're looking at in the census data is the percentage of people that only speak another language and don't speak English.
Okay.
We don't have that many that just speak another language, which is why. Programmatic recommendation number 3 is to establish a rental assistance program. That's your thing.
Hey, here we go.
staff is recommending that the city council consider developing a rental assistance program, but is asking them to allow staff time to identify funding to support that program. It's not something we have identified right now. Berkeley and San Francisco, of course, do have a program. It is the number one thing, as you've mentioned, that comes up as an issue. It's the number one reason people are being evicted because they come home on rent. And so, yes, we recommend that we do acknowledge, and I think council has been interested in the past. They've actually asked if we couldn't use the housing bond funds. It's not eligible. So we can't use those funds to do it. We have to find another funding source. So,
wow, it just seems like, I don't know, even the home buyer program, like, don't get me wrong, I'm a big fan, of course, I got it, but you know, like 6 people out of 30 people have, like, so it just seems like that is like a big pot of money that's not being used that could be.
It's in the law. That's the issue, that the bond funds can only be used towards real property. And so when you're providing somebody money for rental assistance, it's going to an individual. It's not going to an actual real estate property. Mm. And that's where the rub is that happens in that. Mm-hmm. 3 things that they did look at but are not recommending that we do. One is establishing a rental registry. Most cities that have a rental registry, in fact, I think almost all of those that we've looked at that have a rental registry do because they have rent stabilization. We don't have rent stabilization. There is a financial cost to the city in order to establish a rent registry, and there's an administrative burden. So those would be additional costs that the city just can't take on at this time.
Well, this says the rental registry has nothing to do with affordable housing registry.
Same thing.
So you don't need to.
We don't have an affordable housing registry. We have a listing of affordable housing, but we don't have a registry.
So you don't have to register the person who's going into a low income and
have. There's a recertification process, but it's not a registry. Yeah.
What is the registry? Maybe we just need
to. So a rental registry is almost very similar to like a business license tax process. Okay. You pay a fee to register your property with the city, and you are required to then provide certain information back to the city. And it could be a variety of things. The type of things that go in a rental registry are not the things that are collected when you apply for a residential business license.
Mm-hmm.
So
your income doesn't have to be registered when you get affordable housing.
It's for the landlord.
It's the other side.
So in Berkeley, like for example, we had a cottage in the back of our house, and then we wanted to rent it. My mom had to register with the city of Berkeley as a rental property.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So the landlord is the one who's doing the registry.
So they
like, they're identifying these are all the rental properties in the city. They're paying a fee for doing that. Mm-hmm. There's information that's collected.
Mm-hmm. Right, so the landlord does that.
That's what a rental registry is, and we don't have one.
So
but the registry of the rental property.
Yes.
Not the
rental. Some registries do require you to provide tenant information, not all of them, but it's more about the fact that there is a rental property in the city and you're paying a fee for having it.
So when you're a landlord and you maybe make affordable housing agreements and but there's no registry.
It's not a registry. That's like, yes, we're collecting information, but it's not a formal registry. That information is in an Excel document. I don't have a listing of every affordable tenant in the city. I don't have a registry that tells me all that information. I'd actually have to pull each individual report from every property in order to find out who the tenants are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a registry that tells that to me.
But you have it for each individual property.
If they submit the report, yeah, it would tell me who lived in the unit for the year.
But she's a list of units, not a list of people.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I guess I'm getting
confused. It does tell me the people who are in the unit,
yeah.
But it's not a registry. It is information we have, but it's not in a registry. Mm-hmm. It's not a part of a rental registry. That's not what a rental registry is.
Okay.
So would this provide you with better data about, like, the rental?
It absolutely could.
So there's a financial cost to it.
There's a financial cost, and property owners, landlords wouldn't want to do it.
And it's an additional fee.
Yeah.
Right. Because we would have to get software in order to build out the system. There's staffing time that's dedicated to doing these things, and which is why when people have rent stabilization, they use it to manage all of those units in the portfolio, and then they'll expand it on to the units that are not a part of rent stabilization. But we haven't come across anybody who does one who doesn't have rent stabilization.
Yeah. Why don't we have rent stabilization?
We don't have enough units in the city that would qualify that make it worthwhile. Because it's only units that were built prior to a certain year. Mm-hmm. Certain units are excluded. The city was primarily built after that time frame. Mm-hmm. So then, like, our every year, the amount of numbers that would go down even more. The second thing was changing the definition or the distinction of a small to large landlord. This was a request that came from the public that the city council asked us to look into. They wanted us to define a small and large landlord based off of any property they owned. Our definition is strictly about what property they own in Emeryville.
Right.
This is not being recommended to change because it is difficult to determine ownership of a property outside of Emeryville. And if it would be difficult for the city to do it, a tenant would never be able to determine, I'm renting from this person, do they have property somewhere else? It's just almost impossible. It's really, really difficult in order to find that information. So we're not looking to make that change.
Mm-hmm.
And then lastly, they recommended proactive housing inspections. Again, that would be a huge additional financial cost to the city, a huge administrative burden.
Mm-hmm.
The cities that do that, they never can get to all of the rental units in the city. You just can never have the manpower to do it. We are a very small city with a high number of rental properties. We would have to expand our code enforcement division like a lot, and just financially it can't be done.
Yeah. So I was just wondering, this is recommended by the consultant?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
No, it was not. No.
By the
nobody. These are things they looked at. These are different policies that they looked at.
Who are they?
PlaceWorks, our consultant.
Oh,
so they looked at these things as well,
okay,
but determined that they were not recommending us to move forward. And part of it is about, like, other cities may do some of these things, but it didn't seem feasible.
Okay. I have. So, conducting proactive housing inspections, can that just be done by a tenant asking for it instead of going to every single place? Can you just do it case by case? So if it's one building and somebody needs some kind of inspection, then all the units next to it or around it get inspected instead of just taking the whole thing on. And the whole small landlord, big landlord, the city ordinance is the payments for no-fault eviction or assistance
mm-hmm.
in temporary moving, those amounts are different compared to large and small.
Right.
How do you, you can't just have no distinction.
It's not no distinction. It's just based on.
We're not changing our current system.
Oh,
it's based on their ownership
within
Emeryville.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, if you have a lot of units in Emeryville, right, you're
right.
A big landlord. If you just have, like, one or two or something, or a small, then
mm-hmm.
you're a small landlord. But you could have.
I think the question came from a tenant who has a landlord who has many units, but
mm-hmm.
may only have two in Emeryville, and all their other units are in Berkeley.
Right.
And they're feeling that they should have gotten, that they would have wanted to receive a large landlord payment.
I see.
But actually, they're only getting a small landlord payment because the property owner only owns two properties here.
And large landlord distinction, can it get dispersed with LLCs, with a landlord assigning a bunch of different LLCs to owning property, but then having an LLC for this property or that property or that property.
So the LLC owns one property, and then when they're doing the eviction, they identify themselves owning only one property under the LLC because they'd be the property manager or landlord. I don't know if we've seen that.
I don't know if we've seen that because we do. So
Most rental projects, large ones, they all do have a different LLC as the name of the company, but they're still all considered large landlords.
Okay.
I need to look into that. I need to do some research. I don't see that happening, but I need to get more information on what you do better answer.
And then I just have one quick question about the rental registry.
Mm-hmm.
If affordable housing is tied, affordable housing issues or it can be an incentive for landlords for in development. So what rules do they need to follow to get those incentives?
What kind of incentives are you thinking of?
It's like if you are a developer and you say I'm gonna put a walkway or have 10 units or 20 units that are going to be affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
How do they justify the affordable housing units if they're not registered?
What do you mean by
that? How do they prove that they have the city,
because the city records a regulatory agreement against the property and then we monitor.
Without having the landlord register the income rates or the people that
No, are the annual report that all the properties are required to submit an annual report to the city that tells us the rental rates and the affordability and the income and how many units are occupied.
Okay, so now
that's what's in an annual report.
So that thing is different than a rental registry.
Yes.
What is that thing called?
That is a regulatory agreement that's recorded against the property that then tells them the requirements that they have to do in order to maintain that affordable housing. And it includes monitoring, enforcement, things that then they're required to submit to the city on an annual, some properties have it semi-annually basis. So some properties have to, almost all the properties at least once a year have to give us a report that identify, you know, these are the affordable units we have in our regulatory agreement. Let's say it says 52. Well, here are the number of units that I actually rented to people at affordable rental rates. So we're checking. You're supposed to have 52. Could you tell me do you have 52 on this report? We're then looking to see, okay, of the 52 units, there's supposed to be 25 one bedrooms and whatever two bedrooms of your, does that match?
Mm-hmm.
The rents are supposed to be this rate for one bedroom. Does it match what our requirements are? So we check all that information on an annual basis.
Okay. And the requirements for when you're developing, there's phases of it, and you get permits and you get certificates of occupancy according to the agreements that you made about the affordable housing.
Mm-hmm.
Who is overseeing that? And if the affordable housing is not yet in place, how does development continue?
If the affordable housing is not yet in place. So who manages the affordable housing process? That would be me.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is when they go to planning will issue them their entitlements and their conditions of approval. When they go to get their building permit, in order to get their building permit, they have to actually show that they've executed that document that I'm recording against the property.
Right.
Once that happens, they are able to get their building permit. They then build the building. In order to get the certificate of occupancy, they then have to provide certain documentation for me that I actually sign off on their building occupancy. So they have to show us that they've developed their marketing plan. They've had to have gone through they've already gone through the pre-leasing process, have to inspect the units to make sure everything matches.
Right.
And then I have to approve all the initial tenants that move into the unit.
Right.
So that's how we're able to ensure that they're actually providing those units. If I hadn't seen any of those things, I actually don't sign off on the certificate of occupancy. Once the unit is built, then they give us this report every year. So at that point, the unit's already in place. If for whatever reason, they're supposed to give us 25 units and only 12 of the units are occupied, then in the report, we're going to ask them questions. Well, why aren't these other 13 units occupied? What are the issues going on? Or why are you charging more in rent? Person's income is over income. you've got to correct these things. Mm-hmm. So then we'll issue them a compliance report that says things that they have to correct, and we'll usually give them a time period to correct them, and but every single year. So I have not seen a case where somebody was supposed to build something and didn't do it. Mm-hmm. Outside of, we do have projects that had a planning entitlement, but they've never actually gone to the phase of actually applying for their building permit. They're supposed to provide us affordable units, but they haven't built anything yet. So there's nothing for me to do until, and they cannot start the process of getting that building permit until they come and meet with me.
So there's two reasons why we don't use it. So the rental registry primarily is used for rent stabilization. That's not really, that's not something we have to have. And then second, based on what you just explained, it's all the stuff that you may even gather from the registry, we're already acquiring via another.
Yeah. It's in the regulatory agreement.
Yeah, with no.
It's just not in a.
Yeah, no financial cost and no additional burden. So we're like, check, check. Yeah. It's already being done. You don't really need it.
Correct.
Okay. And the other thing I was asking too, the second one, which kind of makes sense. Again, another legal question. I think that this is also, the second one is sound that we don't take it up because I see the legal flags going up about trying to distinguish small and large in a different city.
Right.
Using you know, my homes in Berkeley to determine my smaller large landlord status for something that I own in Emory.
Yeah, I think it's right. Like, I'm going to use you, Brooks. There's no database for me to search to say what properties does Brooks own.
Yeah.
That's the problem.
No, the answer's
none. And he can own something in, you know, with somebody else in X. There's no, what am I searching to determine that?
Yeah.
That's the problem, which is why we're not expanding it beyond.
And it can be self-reported.
How do I make them self-reported?
Yeah, I don't know.
Because right now, there's a business license they have to apply for that requires them to identify how many properties they have. That's why I can determine it in Emeryville, but I can't determine it somewhere else.
Mm-hmm. But again,
and it's proprietary information. So I don't even know if I called another city. And then again, what cities am I calling?
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to be able to tell me yes or no?
Well, for like just in the case with this person that was hoping to get like a higher amount because they were maybe made aware that they had properties in Berkeley or something like that. Are you in that process with them, right? The city's in the process with what is required to the tenant?
They submitted a request to city council at one of the city council meetings. So this came in as a written public comment that they wanted the city to look at expanding this because they know their landlord owns multiple properties in other jurisdictions, just not here in Emeryville, and they wanted us to look at expanding it.
Okay.
That's how it came into us.
Okay. But it's not in terms of the, like, the having the landlord pay when tenants are at no-fault eviction, and we make that determination between small and large landlords.
That's the only time we make it,
But you guys are involved in that process.
Yeah, the determination of small or large landlord at that process, yes.
And at that time, are you able to ask the landlords to self to like state whether they have properties in other, I mean, you know.
They would be honest. I don't, well, we don't do that right now. We don't ask. No.
Yeah.
We go and look at, we go to finance and ask them, we pull up the business license and see how many properties are identified.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we determine it.
Is it possible to make just that extra step of asking them to self verify how many, if they have
and proper, we just have to do that 700 form. We have to state everything.
That's illegal.
No, but
that's illegal.
And not that I have.
I feel like because then, I mean, if they, as a landlord, if they actually do have property that will, if they actually, in actuality, are a large landlord, right, and they're self-reporting that they are not, and somehow that's figured out, I feel like
I wouldn't be mad if a tenant then wanted to get the proper payment. You know what I mean? But if they actually aren't and they state that and it's clear, then no problem for anybody.
It still would require us, though, to change our ordinance to say in any jurisdiction. And then it opens it up for everybody. Mm-hmm. And then the question will come back, well, how do I know?
I think legal is going to raise flags on that when you get outside of the confines of Emeryville. I think
that's my understanding from when it happened originally.
Yeah.
We literally watched the city council meeting from 2016 where this small versus large landlord, because originally, like, there's only us in Concord that do that. Everybody else is one, every landlord pays, and every landlord is paying like how we pay for a large landlord, even small landlords. Mm-hmm. And the city council created the distinction because of the residents that came that were older homeowners primarily, who were like, I own this one unit and this is my, you know, retirement and I'm renting it out, or I have three units and don't penalize me because I don't have $12,000 to pay somebody if I decide I want to move back into my unit. So that's why they created the small landlord distinction, specifically because they came to council and was like, this is a problem. And they were like, okay, we understand. And that's why they created that distinction. And literally in the meeting, it was so interesting because that's not how a city council meeting was run. They were like, how many people own two properties? How many people own 10 properties? Okay, we want less than 10. Now, how many people, like, that's how they came up with the number.
Four.
Four is a small landlord, and then
four,
no, 10. Four. It's four. Yeah, four units. Okay, so those are things we're not recommended. So, I think we've kind of already gone through it. You know, are there anything? I think we've got your comments to this question, so I don't need that. The question is there anything else that you guys did not mention that we didn't talk about that you want us to also consider and look into related to the tenant eviction? Separate from temporary relocation, which will help define the substantial renovation question. We're still working on that. Is there any other issue out there that you guys can think of that we have not addressed?
I just think that the last three still need to be considered and or at least discussed a little more. And I think that the minutia, the whole crux of discretion, interpretation versus definitive, and versus definitive or a very narrow delta for misinterpretation is really important with the ordinance, because it seems to be the crux of things.
Mm-hmm.
And if the sensibility is for tenants, or the sensibility based on a 50-50, or is the sensibility landlord driven? When there's that much room for discretion or misinterpretation, then it can be pushed in directions vastly to suit whatever the motivation of the person who is trying to do their case or to be understood to be understood and to support why they should be understood.
Mm-hmm.
So
specificity wasn't provided here. So I totally hear what you're saying. And I think that it'll be incumbent upon us, PlaceWorks and our attorney, when we get to the part of drafting the ordinance to make sure things are specific.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have all the specificity for you guys today, but the intention is to try to integrate that more into the ordinance as best that we can. There are always going to be some things that the city doesn't want to solve every problem. The city should not solve every problem, right?
Yeah.
So there are going to be gray areas that we don't address because we didn't even know it needed to be addressed. So we can't promise that there won't be some gray areas, but we're going to try to address as many that we can based off of what we've heard, the things that we've seen. We're going to try to put all that in there.
And I think starting with the landlord tenant ordinance as it is right now, I saw that you're going chunk by chunk, but taking that and juxtaposing it, which you already are, but in a way that it can clarify what is unclear here, which is you're already doing it, but I'm saying little by little, this is a lot of stuff in one meeting. It's a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And
I mentioned this briefly. So the question will be, do you guys want to come back and meet in July or do you want to meet in August? Traditionally, most committees don't meet in August because that's when council takes break.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, we've always canceled our July meeting because of the holiday. And so I wanted to bring it to you guys as to, do you want to come back and meet July 1st or would you rather come back and meet August 5th?
Is there a third option? Could we meet like on that eve?
We typically meet the first Wednesday,
mm-hmm.
and in that meeting is where we'll have to discuss about potentially changing the meeting.
Or we're going to have enough time to do that because school starts September 9th. I might be able to come to this September meeting, but by like August meeting, we need to have it on the agenda to see if you guys are willing to make the meeting on another night of the week for at least the end of the semester.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my preference would be just to move it to August and just wait till August 5th. One, because that gives us more time to finish working on the temporary relocation. But
I'm over August 5th, and I'm just
kidding. I mean, you won't be here. This is Brooke's last meeting, and Dolores.
Oh.
This would have been her last meeting as well.
Brooks.
Oh. I have two new people who were approved last night by council to join us.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, watch that. How long is our term?
Everybody's term is 2 years. And so it rotates.
Yeah.
So it's 4 and 3. So Tyler and Ellen both were renewed, and then Brooks and Dolores opted not to participate for next term.
And I had served a little more than a full term
because
I came in on a someone
else. In a minute.
Yeah.
You did.
I don't want to skip over the day, but I have another question regarding this. Like, when I recently was looking at Oakland's tenant protections ordinance, and I feel like their list is like 16 very clear things that then they go into their code and like actual policy. It's like very, very, very detailed when you go in and read all of this stuff after each like sentence. And I just wondered if like as a group, maybe in our own free time, we could check them out because I think there are maybe some things we would want to incorporate that we don't have that are just like very simple things.
Oakland was a part of one of the ones that we did review.
Mm-hmm.
So if there's something in there that you've seen that you would like us to look at, just email it to me.
Okay.
So then I can have Emily and I can pull it up. I can talk to the consultant about it.
Okay.
We had looked at Oakland, and our consultant looked at 7 cities and went through all of their ordinances and what they're doing. Oakland was one of them.
Yeah. And then I don't know if you can cover all off the top of your head, but like where our list is in our meeting, which meeting that would be at? Like if I were to go pull our list. What are current tenant protections?
Oh, where is it? It's in Title 5. Chapter 40 of the municipal code.
Okay. Wow.
Don't ask me on other ones. That one I know. Title 5, public welfare.
Title 5,
chapter 40. I click on it almost every day.
I think we need to.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. We need to go back and approve minutes.
Next meeting, if we decide to do
Wednesday.
Oh, August 5th.
Sorry, yes.
August 5th.
Oh,
August 5th.
Yeah. Okay. So August 5th. So I will, Ellen, does that work for you?
Yes, that's fine.
Okay, great. Thank you. And then, so that's that. And then the minutes,
I have one question on the minutes.
Yeah.
Just on the temporary relocation assistance piece, we did ask a question about how this was going to apply to remote units.
Mm-hmm.
And that seemed to be a question that you were interested in seeing how it might apply. You do have a significant number of work units in the city.
Probably temporary relocation.
Exactly.
Oh, about the business.
About the business, exactly. Like, so some of the issues are a little bit different because it's both a place of work, source of income, as well as a place to live, right? So if you're dislocated, need to relocate from there. It affects other kinds of systems, right? And I think we weren't sure whether the temporary relocation assistance would or would not apply.
Got it.
To live work units.
That was a question. We can modify that. Is there any other modification outside of the live work?
That's it.
That's why I feel like I need to.
So then, are you guys ready to vote on the adoption of the minutes?
I motion for adoption of the May 6th minutes.
Second. And we'll go Chair Krause.
Yes.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Hill.
Aye.
Member Drummond.
Yes.
Member Jessup.
Yes.
Member Zero.
Aye.
Member Oakley.
Yes.
And the minutes pass. Okay. That's all I have. I've bumbled over my time, but I will allow you to adjourn us.
Yes. So on this meeting of the Amerigo Housing Committee on June 17th is adjourned at 8:45.
Thank you, guys. I know it was a lot. I'm going to get this done. Ellen, I'll email. I'll email to everybody the both slide presentations.
Oh yeah,
you guys will have that tomorrow.
Oh great, thank you.
Welcome.
Take a night.